Phoenix Audio presents
The List of Seven by Mark Frost. All the devil requires is acquiescence, not struggle, not conflict, acquiescence. The envelope was vellum, cream, expensive. It was slid under the door silently. The doctor did not hear it, and his ears were keen, sharp as crone's knees, like all his senses. He was in the front room, had been throughout the evening, feeding the fire, absorbed in an obscure text. He turned to study the photograph of Helen Petrovna Blavatsky in the frontpiece. The preternatural stillness, that clear, penetrating gaze. What was he to make of this curious tome? Isis Unveiled, a work purporting to assimilate and eclipse every known spiritual, philosophic, and scientific system of thought. Although, according to the biographical passage under her picture, H.P.B. had spent the better part of her 50-odd years trotting the globe, communing with this or that occultist ashram, she coyly attributed the book's genesis to divine inspiration, courtesy of a steady roster of ascended masters materializing before her like Hamlet's ghost, claiming that occasionally one of these holy of holies stepped inside her head and assumed the reins. Automatic writing, she called it. True, the book possessed two distinctly different styles. He hesitated to term them voices. But as to the content, the thing was a flea market of mumbo-jumbo. Lost continents, cosmic rays, root races, evil cabals of black magicians. To be fair, he had in fact employed similar notions in his own writing, but that was fiction, for God's sake, and she was offering this as theology. He looked up and spied the envelope. Had it just been set there? He silently drew from the umbrella stand his stoutest walking stick, and with its gnarled, blackened knob poised, opened the door. Accompanied by a sharp suck of air as the door swung inward, an enveloping shadow fell away from the hall with the speed of a magician's black silk handkerchief snatched off an ivory tablecloth. The corridor was empty. He registered no sensory impression of any person having been present. He retrieved a sharp lancet and, with surgical exactness, pierced and slit the envelope. A single sheet of vellum, thinner stock than the envelope, but matched, slipped smoothly into his hand. This was clearly a gentleman's or gentlewoman's correspondence. Sir, your presence is required in a matter of utmost urgency pertaining to the fraudulent public practice of the spiritualist arts. As a man of God and science, I beseech your timely response. An innocent's life hangs in the balance. Tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, 13 Cheshire Street. This was not the first such entreaty he had received. The doctor's campaign to expose fraudulent mediums and their loathsome ilk was well known to certain grateful members of London society. The paper carried no scent or perfume. The hand was as studiously genderless as the stationery. Anonymity this complete was practiced. A woman, he concluded, moneyed, learned, vulnerable to scandal, married or related to someone of note or station, a dabbler in the shallows of the spiritual arts. An innocent. A spouse or child, hers. The address given was in the East End, no place for a high-born woman to venture alone. For a man largely unfettered by doubt amidst even the worst uncertainty, there would be none regarding his response. Before delving back into Blavatsky, Dr. Arthur Conan Doyle made a mental note to clean and load his revolver. It was Christmas Day, 1884. The flat where Doyle lived and worked occupied the second floor of an aging building in a working-class neighborhood of London. These were humble quarters, a sitting room and a cramped sleeping chamber, inhabited by a modest man of limited means and a steady, confident manner. By nature, and now in practice, a healer, master of surgery these 4 years, a young man approaching his 26th year. His physician's faith in the infallibility of science was ingrained but brittle. Although he had fallen from the Catholic Church a decade before, there persisted in Doyle a hunger for belief. As he saw it, it now remained the exclusive province of science to empirically establish the existence of the human soul. Yet a wild, weightless yearning for abandon, a ripping away of reality's mask to incite a merging with the mystic, prowled his mind like a wraith. He had never spoken of it, not once, to anyone. To appease that desire for surrender, he read Blavatsky and Emanuel Swedenborg and a host of other long-winded mystics. He attended meetings of the London Spiritualist Alliance. He sought out mediums and seers and psychics, conducted his own parlor seances, visited houses where the dead reportedly did not rest. In every instance, Doyle brought to bear his three cardinal principles: observation, precision, and deduction. These were the cornerstones upon which he had constructed his sense of self, and he recorded his findings clinically as preamble to some larger work whose shape would reveal itself to him only in time. Living with these contradictory impulses, the desire for faith, the need to prove that faith genuine before embracing it, left Doyle with the simple human need to compose his unresolved reactions. He found the ideal forum in writing works of fiction, stories of mythic planes, dread and eldritch deeds committed by plotters of evil intent, contested by men from the world of light and knowledge. In the previous years, Doyle produced four manuscripts. His first three efforts had been dutifully submitted to a succession of publishers where they were uniformly rejected and returned. He was still awaiting response to his most recent composition, a rousing adventure story entitled The Dark Brotherhood, which he considered his most accomplished work for a number of reasons, not the least of which being his fervent desire to lift himself out of shabby, genteel poverty. As to his physical appearance, suffice it to say that Doyle was man enough for the tasks he set himself. Sturdy, athletic, without vanity, but not above a conditioned twinge of shame if he encountered social betters while wearing cuff or collar frayed by his financial limits. The fairer sex aroused in him a natural and healthy interest, but also, on occasion, tapped a vein of vulnerability, a pocket of frailty and indecision in an otherwise granite facing. This tendency had never offered more of a predicament than the stranded vexations and anxieties posed to any younger man in the pursuit of love. As he was about to discover, it would soon present far graver consequences. 13 Cheshire Street stood packed in the center of a residential shanty row as flimsy as playing cards. Doyle looked from the shadows across the street. He had arrived an hour earlier than that requested by the letter. A pale aurora of gaslight lined the curtains of the forward parlor. The lace moved. A dark male face dimly seen studied the street below, then withdrew. At 7:20, a squat figure, covered in an accretion of dark, tattered shawls, ambled down the street, climbed the stairs, and methodically knocked three times, paused, then rapped a fourth. The door opened, and the figure entered. 5 minutes later, a young boy sprinted into view, straight to the door, where he repeated the same knock. Shabbily dressed, an urchin, carrying a bulky, irregular bundle wrapped in newsprint. Between 7:40 and 7:50, two couples arrived, the first on foot, lower class, the woman sallow, heavy with child, the man thick-built for manual labor. They also employed the signal knock. The second couple came by carriage, not a hansom, a private vehicle. Judging from the stallion's heavy lather, they had traveled at high speed from somewhere 45 minutes to an hour away. The coachman dismounted and opened the door. A young man alighted first, slender and pallid, bearing the tremulous conceit of a privileged university student. Curtly brushing the coachman aside, he lent a hand to the coach's second passenger as she descended. Bonnet and shawl framed a pale, oval face, a familiar resemblance to the younger man. His sister, Doyle chanced, 2 or 3 years her senior. The woman glanced anxiously about the street. "This is the author of the note, and she is looking for me," Doyle realized. He was on the verge of starting across to them when the door opened and the house swallowed them up. Doyle abandoned his post and crossed the street towards the coachman. "Pardon me, friend," said Doyle, putting on an affable, half-pixelated smile. "This wouldn't be where they're having that spiritualist thingamajig now, would it? I was told 13 Cheshire."
"Wouldn't know about that, sir. Most likely the truth."
"But wasn't that Lady Watsis and her brother? Well, of course, you're their driver, Sid, isn't it?"
"Tim, sir."
"Tim, right. You picked up the missus and me at the train when we visited out to the country that weekend."
The man peered uncomfortably askance at Doyle, feeling a social obligation to harmonize.
"Out to Topping, then?"
"That's right. Now, I'm trying to recall, was her brother there that weekend, or was he off at Oxford?"
"Cambridge." "No, he was there, I think, sir."
"That's enough," thought Doyle. "I'm pressing my luck as it is."
"It's nearly 8. I'd best get inside. Cheers. Keep warm."
"Thank you, sir," said Tim.
Doyle took the steps. Lady Caroline Nicholson, the full name, leapt immediately to mind. Husband's father in government, hereditary peerage, Topping their ancestral manse, somewhere in Sussex. He raised the cudgel end of his walking stick, but before he made contact, the door swung open, probably not closed properly. The center hall was dark, closed doors to the left, right, and straight ahead. The door behind him swung shut. Doyle reassured himself by recalling a gust of wind of sufficient force to initiate the securing of the latch. Except that on the parson's table, the candle's flame had not flinched or faltered. Doyle passed his hand over the flame. It danced agreeably. The door to the right opened. The boy he'd seen before stood there, looking up at him without surprise.
"I'm here for the seance," Doyle said.
The boy opened the door and bowed stiffly, waving Doyle through. He moved past the boy into the parlor. Chanting voices issued from behind closed sliding doors directly ahead. The door snicked shut behind him, the boy gone. Doyle treaded softly to the doors and listened. The door slid open. The boy stood on the other side now. Behind him, the seance was already in progress. Lady Nicholson spotted Doyle first. He saw recognition, instantly dampened to ward off discovery. A nimble mind, he concluded, slightly preceded by the thought, "Here is the most beautiful face I have ever seen." The table was round, covered in pale linen, in the center of the shadowy room. Doyle could make out 6 figures seated at the table holding hands. To Lady Nicholson's right was her brother, the pregnant serving girl, the man Doyle identified as her husband, the swarthy man from the window, and finally the medium. Her eyes were closed, her head inclined back to the ceiling, exposing the fleshy wattles of her throat. The dark man saw Doyle next. His eyes pierced the air between them, obsidian black, set like jeweled stones in deep round holes. "Join us," the dark man appeared to whisper. Doyle let the boy draw him forward to an empty chair. As he accepted the dark man's offered hand with his right, the man to his left seized Doyle's free hand and clenched tight. When Doyle turned to Lady Nicholson, seated directly across from him, he encountered the ardent gaze of a woman who had just had a lifetime's polite, social dissembling torn away by the chamber's tonic of wonder and terror, awakening to find herself brazenly alive. That vitality illuminated her extraordinary beauty. Her aquamarine eyes danced kaleidoscopically, and high color brushed her pale cheeks. She mouthed the words, "Thank you." Doyle felt an involuntary thump and a skip in his chest. Adrenaline, he observed with interest. The intrusive jolt of an alien voice broke the connection.
"We have strangers here tonight."
It was a man's voice, deep-chested, veined with a seductive, graveled tremulo. The voice was issuing from the medium's throat. The woman's facial structure had perceptibly changed shape from the pie-shaped, waxy, to a cast more ruddy, skeletal and square. Eyes gleaming with a reptilian glint, her mouth slithered into a salacious grin. In his studies, Doyle could recall only 2 accounts of this phenomenon, physiological transmogrification, and had never before encountered it in situ.
"We all humbly seek your guidance."
The dark man's accent was foreign, Mediterranean, perhaps. So this man was the medium's liaison to the paying customer, usually the brains behind the operation. Fraud began here. An opportunistic salesman exploiting what in many instances were mediums with some measurable facility and a childish incomprehension of the workaday world's mercantile realities. Clearly, Lady Nicholson was their target.
"You've come to ask me of your son," said the medium.
Tears pooled quickly in Lady Nicholson's eyes.
"Oh, my God, how did you know?"
"He's disappeared," the brother offered. "4 days now. He's only 3 years old."
"His name is William,"
the medium said without hesitation. It would have been the dark man's job to find that out. A gasp broke from the pregnant girl. She was staring at a spot some 6 feet above the table where a perfect sphere of white mist was materializing, spinning like a globe on a central pivot. The shards spread out and began assuming the dimensions of a random topography, foothills, rifts, peninsulas. The features crystallized, less precise than a photograph, but more animated. A young boy lay curled up at the base of a tree. His hands and feet were tightly bound with rope, the chest heaving. The ghostly and unmistakable sound of a child's pathetic, heartsick cries filtered into the chamber.
"God in heaven, it's him, it's him,"
Lady Nicholson moaned. "Where is he?" the brother demanded. The air in the room was rent by a shattering, discordant blast of trumpets, an insane trilling bound by no discernible harmony or rhythm.
"The horn of Gabriel!"
shrieked the man to Doyle's left. Now something black and odious crept into the edge of the image, suspended above them, advancing towards the helpless child. An inescapable conviction that he had witnessed this entity the night before in the hall outside his door left Doyle vainly groping for some rational causation. A long brass horn appeared in the air opposite the picture. Now that's their first mistake, Doyle thought. He sprang to his feet and yanked his hands free. He picked up his chair and hurled it at the image. It shattered like liquid glass. Its suspending cable severed, the brass trumpet clattered noisily onto the table. Rolling to avoid the blow, Doyle felt the fist of the man to his left connect sharply below his shoulder blade. In one swift move, Doyle snatched the trumpet from the table and swung it viciously, catching the man square on the side of the face. Blood spurted from a gash as he fell to his knees. Doyle reached into his pocket for the revolver when a heavy blow landed on the right side of his neck. The dark man lifted a truncheon to strike again.
"Fool!"
the voice issued from the medium. Grinning maliciously, eyes blazing, she swiftly rose straight up into the air above the table.
"You fancy yourself a seeker of truth?"
She held out her palms. The skin roiled and rippled with hideous subcutaneous congestion. Opening her mouth, a flowing volume of gray, aqueous vapor then billowed forth, tracing the image of a full-length mirror. The medium's reflection appeared in the spectral glass.
"Then behold my true face."
Out of the void behind her likeness in the mirror floated another form, a skull-like creature with red, abscessed sockets for eyes, skin gray and in many places gnawed down to the bone, writhing pockets of black, stringy hair. Independent of the medium who remained still, the creature opened the spoiled cavity that served as its mouth. Its voice was the one they had been hearing all along. Two hooded figures moved out from behind the tapestry. One clouted Lady Nicholson's brother across the head, the wound spouting crimson as he fell away. The other grabbed Lady Nicholson and drew a long, thin blade smoothly across her throat, severing the vessels, arterial blood pumping furiously. The cry in her throat died in a drowning rattle as she slumped out of sight behind the table. "God, no!" Doyle screamed. A demented cackle from the monster filled the air before the ectoplasmic mirror exploded in a loud report of light. One of the murderers drew his sights on Doyle, but a dagger had pierced the span of his neck. The man staggered, then toppled over. With a grunt, the accomplice holding Doyle fell backwards and away. An unfamiliar man's voice spoke urgently in his ear. "Your pistol, Doyle." Looking up to see the dark man with a truncheon raised, Doyle pulled the pistol from his pocket and fired. His left knee shattered. The dark man bellowed and fell to the floor. Still unseen, Doyle's benefactor overturned the heavy table, throwing back another assassin. Hands pulled Doyle to his feet. "Follow me," the voice instructed. "Lady Nicholson, too late." Doyle followed the voice into the darkness. They passed through a door, down a corridor. It was not the way he had entered. A shape leapt from the dark with a feral growl and ripped into the man's forward leg. Doyle fired a shot at the dim shape of the attacking animal. The man shouldered through the door. In the shaft of light that fell back through the doorway, Doyle saw the still body of the street urchin, jaws pulled back in a death grimace, exposing blood and meat in its sharp canine teeth. His deliverer took the lead in a headlong dash down the dark alley outside. Breaking out of an alley onto a paved street, the man stopped short, yanking Doyle back into the sheltering darkness. At the corner of an intersecting alley across the way was the surviving gray-hooded killer. A carriage approached from the left. Four immense black stallions roared into view, clattering noisily to stop on the cobblestones. The six-seat coach stood huge and black as pitch. No driver was visible. The gray hood moved to the side of the coach. A window slid open, but no light issued from within. Then the hood stepped towards them, stopped and cocked its head, like a hound tracing frequencies beyond human range. Something not right. Doyle realized there were no holes for the eyes. The door to the black carriage swung open. A short, strident, high-pitched trilling filled the air. The gray hood instantly turned and leapt into the cab, and the steeds hammered the heavy carriage away. With that, the man was off again. Doyle had no choice but to follow. They turned the corner and came upon a waiting hansom cab, a compact cabbie atop the driver's perch. The man signaled, and the hack driver turned, offering a view of the ragged scar running obliquely down the right side of his face. He cracked the whip as the man opened the door of the moving vehicle and jumped aboard. "Come on, then, Doyle," the man said. Doyle followed up onto the stair when he heard a dull thump to his right. A long, wicked blade had just penetrated the cab door, its quivering razor tip mere inches from Doyle's chest. The gray hood was 20 yards back, sprinting towards him at improbable speed, then jumped onto the running board of the accelerating coach. Hands pulled Doyle back into the cab. He looked to see a flash of flapping coattail. His friend had fled. As the hooded figure captured its balance in the doorframe, Doyle heard the scuff of weight on the roof, then, through the open window, saw his friend swing down and drive both feet into the open door, rocketing the point of the embedded dagger completely through the attacker's chest. The hood kicked and clawed ferociously, then went suddenly and entirely limp. Feeling a pulse and finding none, Doyle was about to remark on the curious absence of blood when his defender reached in through the window and pulled off the gray hood. Good Christ! A hatch pattern of symmetrical scars crisscrossed the stark white face. The man's eyes and lips had been crudely knitted up with a coarse, waxy blue thread. Doyle's companion reopened the door, and the body swung out with it. With a strong pull, he drew the long knife back through the door, and the body fell away into obscurity. In one deft move, the man pivoted into the cab, pulled the door shut, and took a seat across from the stunned Doyle. "Care for a drink?" said the man, offering a silver flask. Doyle accepted it and drank. It was exceedingly good cognac. Doyle saw him clearly for the first time in the pale amber light of the cabin lantern. His face was narrow, long, jet-black hair curled behind his ears, high forehead, aquiline nose, strong jaw. The eyes were remarkable, light and sharp, colored by a habitual amusement that Doyle felt, to say the least, was currently inappropriate. "You knew my name. Doyle, isn't it? And you're..."
"Sacker. Armand Sacker."
The man wore black head to toe. Lifting a leg of his trousers, he exposed the bloodied bite on his calf given by the feral boy. He took a handkerchief from his pocket, soaked it with cognac, and without flinching, compressed it tightly to the wound. Closing his eyes was the only concession to what Doyle knew must be extraordinary pain. When they reopened, no trace of it remained.
"Right. So, Doyle, tell me how you came to be in that house tonight."
Doyle recounted the arrival of the letter and his decision to attend.
"Right," said Sacker. "Not that you necessarily need me to tell you this, but you're in a bit of a fix."
"Who are you?" asked Doyle.
"Professor, Cambridge, Antiquities." "Could I see some identification to that effect?"
Sacker produced a calling card verifying the assertion.
"I'll keep this," said Doyle, taking another drink. "You recently circulated a manuscript of yours for publication entitled, have I got this right, The Dark Brotherhood?"
How could he know that, thought Doyle.
A coven of evil masterminds colluding with some, shall we say, delinquent spirits? What's my book got to do with what's happened tonight? You've written a manuscript of fiction, but by some elusive process, you have drawn down into your work an uncanny approximation of the depraved plottings of a malignant set of black magicians, seeking an end not at all unlike that pursued by your characters, which was to elicit the help of evil spirits in annihilating the membrane that separates the physical and spiritual worlds, in order to gain dominion over the material world and those who inhabit it. Right. And if tonight's seance was any indication, my friend, they have breached the battlements and set foot across the threshold. Doyle's mind struggled to stay above the flood tide of shock and dismay. The fact was, he had borrowed not only the title of his book, but his villain's motives from the woolliest works of Madame Blavatsky. Who would have thought his petty larceny would come so hideously home to roost? They think I've somehow stumbled on to their plan. And they intend to kill you for your trouble, brutally, without delay. Doyle stared at him. What's all this got to do with you? Oh, I've been on to these rogues a good sight longer than you have. Fortunately, my tracking put me close at hand this evening. Unfortunately, I'm something of a marked man now as well. Sacker rapped sharply on the roof. Stop here, Barry! The carriage came to a sudden halt. I wouldn't bother going to the police with all this. They'll think you mad, and word will only filter up to someone who could do you greater harm. Greater than murder? All trace of a smile vanished. There are worse things, he said, then opened the door. In his dazed, bewildered state, the next thing Doyle knew, he was standing on the street outside his front door, watching the scar-faced cabbie tip his hat, turn, and whip the carriage hurriedly into the night. A maelstrom whirled inside Doyle's mind. He looked at his watch. 9:52. Forms and faces swam out of the dark. Every shadow seemed to pulse with hidden, unspeakable danger. A face looked down at them from a high window. His neighbor, the Russian woman, Petrovich. Wait, had there been a second face behind hers? Doyle took revolver in hand and slowly ascended the 21 steps. The door to his room came into view. It stood open. The wood where the doorknob used to reside was splintered like so many matchsticks. Doyle leaned back against the wall and listened. With a light touch, he eased the door open and gasped at what lay before him. Every square inch of the front room looked to have been drooled or saturated with a clear, viscous fluid. Stepping inside, he felt the ooze suck at the soles of his shoes, but no residue clung to them when he lifted his foot. The surface of every object in the room had been partially liquefied, then cooled and hardened. Doyle picked up one of his books from the desk. It seemed to weigh about the same, but it wobbled in his hand, spineless as an overcooked vegetable. Doyle made his way to the bedroom and saw that the strange liquefaction had penetrated a few inches and then stopped. Pulling his Gladstone bag from the closet, he dropped into it the invertebrate book, a change of clothes, his shaving kit, and a box of ammunition. Back through the vulcanized room, Doyle stopped at the door. Someone outside, the scuff of a shoe. He bent down to peer through the extruded keyhole and saw Petrovich leaning against the balustrade, hands clutched to her scrawny bosom. "Mrs. Petrovich, what's happened here?" He couldn't recall the extent of her English, but it seemed at this moment particularly lean. "Big, big!" she said. Glancing past her, he noticed another woman hanging back at the foot of the stairs, the second face he'd seen in the window, a short, stout woman, round face, penetrating eyes, something familiar about her. "Dear Mrs. Petrovich, did you see anything? A man?" She shook her head. "Black," she said simply. "Black!" "Mrs. Petrovich, go to your rooms. Stay there. My friend is..." "I'll meet your friend another time. Do as I've told you, Mrs. Petrovich, please," he said. Doyle spent what remained of the night at St. Bartholomew's Hospital, sleeping on one of the cots set aside for working physicians. He spoke to no one, not even his closest colleagues, of his trouble.
As he walked into the cool morning air, he found his terror and disorientation receding, and what quickly came to the fore was fury at the brutal slaying of Lady Nicholson and her brother. Despite Sacker's admonition, his first stop upon leaving the hospital that morning was Scotland Yard. An hour later, Doyle was standing inside 13 Cheshire Street with Inspector Claude Lebeau. The room appeared entirely different from the one in which he'd spent those dreadful minutes. Cramped with dusty, fussy furniture, no round table or hanging tapestries, even the ceiling seemed lower.
"Where was the violence done, Arthur?"
Doyle moved to the spot where the table had been sitting. "Here," he said, kneeling down. The floorboards were unstained. "It's been cleaned. They've removed every trace," Doyle said, a bit frantic. Lebeau stood above him, stoic, noncommittal. Doyle bent to examine the floor more closely. He took a pipe-cleaning tool from his pocket and scraped. His efforts yielded a small portion of a dried, dark matter. Doyle brushed the crumbs into an envelope and handed it to Lebeau. "I think you will find this substance is human blood." Lebeau pocketed the envelope. As they stood in the alley looking back at the house, Doyle sketched in the details of the murderous engagement. He made no mention of Sacker or his use of the pistol Lebeau himself had given him months before.
"You say this attack on the woman involved the use of a blade?"
was Lebeau's first comment.
"Yes, a wicked-looking affair."
Lebeau nodded.
"You'd better come with me, then."
They walked three blocks to a vacant lot at the corner of Commercial and Aldgate. Police had sequestered the area. Lebeau led Doyle to the center of the lot where that previous night, just as Doyle was arriving back at his rooms, the short, sorry life of a streetwalker had come to a brutal and malicious end. The rough canvas serving as her shroud was lifted. She was unclothed. The body had been eviscerated and the organs removed. Some were missing. The rest were neatly arranged outside the body, in a pattern the significance of which was impossible to divine.
"Would that be Lady Nicholson, then, Arthur?" Lebeau finally asked.
"No. I've never seen her before."
With shock, Doyle realized that Lebeau was probing for some weakness in his story.
"Now, these blades you described, could they have done this work?"
"Yes, very possibly."
Lebeau blinked myopically.
"Could you describe the assailants?"
"They wore hoods," Doyle said, neglecting to mention that both killers had themselves been dispatched.
Lebeau, of course, sensed that Doyle was withholding key parts of his story, but was mindful enough of their friendship to allow him to part company at this point. Upon first viewing the woman's loathsomely mutilated corpse, one of the troubling thoughts he was still contending with had been, "This is the work of a doctor." Doyle took out Sacker's calling card. Cambridge was less than 2 hours by train. Tim, their driver, told him Lady Nicholson's brother had been at university there. A possible connection. As he replaced the card in his bag, his eye caught the cover of the altered book. Isis Unveiled. He'd been in such a state he hadn't even noticed. Blavatsky's photograph was still discernible through the rippling layer of... Good Christ! The woman he'd seen with Petrovich on the stairs of his building. It was Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. A quick glance inside Doyle's apartment told him nothing had changed since last night. He took the stairs three at a time to Petrovich's floor and knocked vigorously on the door. He noticed smoke seeping out from under the jamb, stepped back and with a heavy thrust kicked the door open. Petrovich lay on the floor. Doyle ripped down the curtains, furiously beating back the fire so he could reach the fallen woman. He touched her and instantly knew she was dead. Petrovich's dachshund wiggled out from under a sofa as Doyle studied the room. An open decanter of wine stood on a table, the stopper beside it, next to an open tin of digitalis pills. There were a number of pills on the floor near the body. The dog gobbled one up off the rug and keeled over, foam bubbling at the corner of its mouth. Poisoned. Doyle lifted Petrovich slightly, livid bruises on either side of her jaw. Her assailant forced the poison on her, then fled out the open window, the candlestick knocked over during the struggle, or perhaps more deliberately by the killer to obscure the deed. Doyle noticed a spot of white peeking out from behind a small mirror on the wall. He pulled out a piece of paper and read, "Dr. Doyle, urgent we speak. I am off to Cambridge. Trust no one. Nothing is as it seems. H.P.B. Doyle detected no one following him to the station. After he took a corner seat with an unobstructed view of the door, no one entered the car who took even a passing notice of him. A bulky Indian woman took the seat opposite Doyle, her brown face obscured by a veil that revealed only her almond eyes and a daub of decorative scarlet on the forehead between them. An external representation of the mystical third eye, recalled Doyle, from his Hindi dabbling. High caste, he decided, assessing her clothes and comportment. He wondered why she wasn't traveling first class, accompanied by family or chaperone. As the train left the London environs, Doyle drifted towards sleep. There was a poster plastered to a pillar just outside the Cambridge rail station. "Lecture tonight. Theosophical Society, H.P. Blavatsky, 8 p.m., the Guildhall near Marketplace." Doyle set out for the offices of Professor Armand Sacker. The afternoon's sallow light was just beginning to fall. Across the commons from St. Mary's Church stood the great classical facade of King's College. Entering the only building to display a light, he heard a scuffling sound and wheezy snort that drew him to the entrance of a long library. A wizened clerk shuffled piles of books in a seemingly aimless pattern between stacks and a mammoth-wheeled cart. "Pardon me, I'm wondering if you could direct me to Professor Sacker."
"Term's over. He's not here."
"So there is, in fact, a Professor Armand Sacker?"
"You're the one who wants to see him."
"You've been most helpful," answered Doyle. One full stomach, and 2 hours later, Doyle was sitting amidst a modest gathering of transcendentalists at the local Grange Hall. H.P. Blavatsky spoke extemporaneously, and the effect was undeniably mesmerizing. Her heavily accented English, broken and tentative to start with, flowed in a grammatically impeccable silver stream.
"There exists in the world today sacred wisdom which dwarfs our puny notions of history. Books of ancient origin hidden for centuries from the Western eye. The northern Buddhists of Tibet alone possessed 325 volumes.
Doyle glanced around the room and noticed that the Indian woman who had ridden up with him on the train was sitting one row over.
The early Christians scoured the world for these ancient doctrines, and they obliterated them almost entirely in the Western world. The library at Alexandria, the last great archive whose contents straddled the pre- and post-Christian worlds, burned to the ground. This is why our travels, our work as theosophists, must always take us to the East. Why has this knowledge of the secret science remained hidden from the Western masses? Because contained within are the keys to understanding the essential mysteries of life. Woe betide us all if they should ever fall into the wrong hands."
Her eyes rested on Doyle for the first time, then moved on. When her presentation was at an end, applause was brief and polite. A short, nattily dressed woman with a monocle and walking stick appeared at Doyle's side.
"Mr. Doyle?"
"Yes."
"My name is Dion Fortune. H.P.B. would like to speak with you."
Doyle nodded and followed. Her handshake was firm and cool. She looked him right in the eye with concern and warm support. They were in a cramped dressing room to a rumbling furnace.
"Petrovich is dead," said Doyle.
Her features hardened.
"Would you like to drink with me?" she asked. "I recommend something stiff."
Doyle nodded. He was grateful for the vodka, as it seemed to elicit a smoother recitation of his story. He showed her the altered book from his rooms.
"What could have caused such a thing?" he asked. "Ectoplasmic detonation, an entity breaking through from the other side."
Doyle's mind spun.
"Madame Blavatsky, what can you tell me about the Dark Brotherhood?"
"Evil beings, materialists, enemies of Holy Spirit. They are spirits who desire human form. They hunger, hovering around it, seeking entry.
For which, as you write, they require the cooperation of the living." Cooperation and sacrifice, yes. They must be invited on to this plane through the enactment of rituals and so forth. Describe for me, if you would, this Professor Armand Sacker.
Tall, rangy, mid-30s, athletic.
This prompted a look between his hosts. There were footsteps outside the door, then a knock. Fortune opened the door. Professor Sacker entered. Doyle shook the infirm hand of the stooped, diminutive, white-haired, 82-year-old man before him.
Professor, please go ahead to the restaurant with Mrs. Fortune. I will be along to join you momentarily,
Blavatsky said. Fortune smoothly guided Sacker out of the room. Blavatsky turned back to Doyle, reading the shock on his face.
Listen carefully, Doctor. I am leaving early in the morning for Liverpool, and from there in 2 days' time sailing to America. This is a most dangerous time for many initiates in many places, and my presence is promised elsewhere. As mystics are to the occult, there are individuals known as sorcerers to magic. Magic is the left-handed path of knowledge. It is the shortest way to the enlightenment we all seek. It has a higher cost. It seems to me that what the man who presented himself to you as Professor Sacker has told you was correct in many details. You have been made a target by a group traveling the left-handed path. You must not waver in your determination. It is your strongest asset. You must not fear, for that will let them in. When things appear darkest, you have friends unknown or unseen. A swirl of her cloak and she was out the door. Doyle's head swam. He spotted a large book on the floor, picked it up, and followed her. She was nowhere to be seen. A short stack of her other works had been left behind on the table in the empty Grange Hall. He looked at the cover of the larger book in his hand. Psychic Self-Defense by H.P. Blavatsky. First things first, lodging for the night. Doyle took a seat by the fire in the public room of the inn he found, and nursed a hot buttered rum. Something caught his eye. The Indian woman again ascending the stairs, staying the night, apparently. The false Sacker came back into his mind. Could he be in league with the villains, insinuating himself into Doyle's confidence for some more sinister purpose? For all Doyle knew, during their carriage ride, he might have been cheek to jowl with the Grand Master of the Brotherhood. With a howl of wind, the front door flew open, and in strode a towering figure in black, face obscured by a high-collared cloak and tri-cornered hat. Doyle obeyed an impulse to pull back behind a chair and avoid the intruder's eye. He chanced another look in time to see the smile instantly vanish from the innkeeper's face. Although Doyle could not discern what the stranger was saying, the fulminating, guttural intent of his tone was unmistakably menacing. Picking up his bag, Doyle discreetly made his way to the back stair. He entered his room and saw that the window on the far wall was flapping open, the rain that was just starting to fall splashing in over the sill. He moved to close it. Standing at the inn's entrance was the same pitch-black carriage he'd seen on the night of the séance. A figure in a black cowled cape held the reins of the four black stallions. Doyle saw the gray hood covering the figure's face. It pointed at him and emitted its deafening, high-pitched wail. Doyle slammed the window shut, reached in his bag for the pistol, and hustled to the door. Moving down the hall, he saw the Indian woman in a half-open doorway.
"Hurry, for God's sake, Doyle," the woman said in a man's voice.
Doyle ran for the door and entered, as behind him the attackers reached the floor he was on and headed towards his room.
"Help me out of these clothes," said the man he'd known as Professor Armand Sacker.
Doyle gaped at him. The sounds of the heavy blows and splintering wood ran down the corridor. He assisted as the man stripped off the padded sari, revealing the same black outfit he'd worn the night they'd met, and quickly toweled off the brown makeup on his face.
"We'll have to take the roof."
Doyle heard a creak and looked up to see one of the gray hoods opening the window above the bed. Grabbing the first solid object he could find, he reared back and hurled it at the creature, hitting it square in the center of the hood, knocking it away from the window. They heard a clatter of roof shingles, then a heavy impact below. The false Sacker picked up the projectile from beneath the window.
"Good old Blavatsky," he said, handing the edition of Psychic Self-Defense back to Doyle before climbing through the window.
Doyle hoisted out his bag and joined him on the roof.
Each step on the rain-soaked shingles was perilously slick. The storm howled around them.
"What do I call you?" Doyle asked. "Call me Jack."
They made their way to the rear edge of the roof. The street, 20 feet below, was empty. Jack put 2 fingers into his mouth and whistled loudly enough to pierce the wind. Doyle thought he heard a carriage approaching below. Before Doyle could further organize his objections, Jack grabbed him by the belt and jumped off the building. They hit the roof of the moving carriage and ripped right through the fabric, landing in a heap on the cushions of the cab. Doyle quickly took inventory. Save some discomfort in the ribs and a slightly turned ankle, he found himself surprisingly intact. As they rushed past the coach outside the inn, Doyle dimly made out dark figures scrambling after them in the downpour. Doyle heard the crack of the whip and the cab accelerated. The carriage clattered across a short bridge and came to a sudden halt. Jack leapt from the cab and held open the door. "Come on, Doyle, we haven't got all night." As the cab sped off again into the darkness, Jack pulled Doyle in under the relative dryness of the span of the bridge. There was a deafening thunder of a carriage and 4 horses hurtling across the bridge a foot above their heads. The sound moved away, quickly swallowed up by the storm.
"Look here, Jack, or whatever your name is, before we go any farther, I'd very much like to know exactly who you are."
"John Sparks, Jack to my friends, special agent to Her Majesty the Queen," he said, offering a flask. "A little brandy to keep the chill off, Doctor."
Clinging to the bridge's underbelly, fearful of plunging into the icy cataract below, Doyle did not enjoy a moment's rest during the remainder of the night. Sparks, on the other hand, seemed to float in and out of a serene, meditative slumber, upright, his arms nonchalantly wrapped around a sturdy timber. The rain abated as the first light of dawn warmed the eastern sky. Sparks' eyes sprang open, fresh and alert as a thoroughbred on Derby Day. Stiff as a corpse, wet, famished, and bruised, Doyle dragged himself out onto the road, stifling with considerable effort his irritation at the man's enthusiasm as Sparks flew through an exotic routine of improbable yogic postures, accompanied by vocalizations that suggested the nocturnal braying of ill-bred cats. He smiled and walked briskly down the road.
"Jack, where are we going?"
"Where do you want to go?"
"I had entertained some vague plan of going to Topping, the home of Lady Nicholson and her brother."
"East Sussex, near the town of Rye. Come on, Doyle, we've got a long walk ahead of us."
The sun continued its morning climb, chasing the chill from their bones, blotting up the first layer of damp from their clothes. At Sparks' request, Doyle recounted his experiences since they had parted in London, remembering to leave out his visit with Le Beau of Scotland Yard.
"Allow me to unburden you, Doyle. Don't bother lying to me."
How did you know?"
"I was following you."
They walked on. The fields ran uninterrupted in every direction. Nothing in Sparks' actions suggested he was anything other than what he presented himself to be, but he remained impenetrable, and the cloaking of royal secrecy around his true purpose rang discordantly. Doyle was in no position to reject the man's assistance, but common sense prevented the full conferring of his trust. It was as if he were traveling with an exotic jungle cat, its defensive abilities beyond reproach, but whose very nature demanded of its keeper a tireless, wary scrutiny. It was near midday by now, and unseasonably warm. Before too long they could hear beating hooves, a single horse. The rider appeared to a startled Doyle as a familiar face.
"Why, it's Barry," said Doyle.
"No, it's not Barry," Sparks said.
He moved away to greet whoever it was.
"Good man, Larry. No trouble, then. Larry and Barry are identical twins."
"We were, anyway. Barry's the one's got the scar."
"Larry and Barry are something of a legend in certain London circles," Sparks said. "The sharpest pair of crack men you'd ever hope to meet."
"Crack men?"
"Burglar, sir," said Larry.
"You'll appreciate the elegance of their methodology, Doyle. While one of them goes out on the town and holds forth in a pub, generally making a spectacle of himself, the other brother goes about the field work. They're never seen together in public, so even if the brother on the job is pinched red-handed, 40 eyewitnesses in the pub are ready to swear they spent the evening in the accused's flamboyant company."
Larry had brought sandwiches, packages of nuts and sweets, water and cool beer, and perhaps most welcome of all, a change of dry clothes for them both. Freshly fortified and wearing dry shoes again, Doyle and Sparks set off once more. Larry mounted and rode off ahead of them to perform some undisclosed advance guard action. They passed the remainder of the afternoon through meadows and birch woods and blasted fallow flatlands until sundown found them at Path's End on the banks of the River Colne. After a quiet evening meal under a sheltering oak, Larry appeared again as darkness fell, putting into shore near their camp at the helm of a 20-foot sloop. Under a clear night sky and the light of a 3/4 moon, they pushed off and drifted silently downstream with the current. Doyle slept through the night, waking refreshed and more than a little startled to find the boat passing landfall and approaching the open sea.
"I don't suppose you remember the name of that last publisher you submitted your book to?" Sparks asked.
"Could have been any one of several. My account book was lost in the shambles of my room. How did they do it, Jack? I can manufacture an explanation for nearly everything else, the séance and even beyond." Sparks nodded thoughtfully, chewing on his pipe.
"There's also the matter of the Grey Hoods. Larry's seen one of them up close, haven't you, Larry?"
"A few months back, sir," he said, "on the job of tailing a certain gentleman."
"A material suspect in my investigation," added Sparks.
"Right. I entered the man's house in his absence, and have a butcher's about the premises to see what's what. After tossing the joint with disappointing returns, as I made my way back through the basement, I spied a door standing ajar. I noticed a boot inside that door."
"One of the Grey Hoods," said Doyle.
"Seated on a stool in the dark. I cautiously reached out and touched the man's hand. Never moved a muscle. I took off the hood."
"The blue thread?"
"The eyes were closed, but the lids were not sewn shut. I realized I knew this fellow. Lansdowne Dilks, convicted of murder most foul, and packed off to prison 3 years ago."
"What did you do?"
"I heard the front door open upstairs, and Lansdowne's eyes opened."
"Did he recognize you?"
"Well, it's difficult to say, sir, 'cause I blew out that candle and was through that window and halfway down the alley outside before the room got dark."
"Whose house was this?" Doyle finally asked.
"Brigadier General Marcus Macaulay Drummond, Royal Fusiliers, retired," said Sparks. "The Drummonds are one of the nation's most prominent munitions manufacturers. They own plants in Blackpool and Manchester, as well as 3 German companies producing heavy artillery. Upon the death of his father 6 years ago, the general assumed control of the family concern. Sales and profits have tripled. Last year, Drummond married his eldest daughter into the Krupps family of Munich, his most formidable competitor on the continent. The result is a potential monopoly of the international as well as the domestic market."
"I don't suppose you could prosecute Drummond for harboring a fugitive?"
"There was no trace of Mr. Dilks or any other Grey Hood on Larry's subsequent visits. Even so, the case presents more insurmountable difficulties."
"How's that?"
"According to the records of the Central Criminal Court, the prisoner Lansdowne Dilks died in the hangman's noose last February."
As the sun reached its ascendant, land appeared on the southern horizon.
"The late Lady Nicholson's husband came to my attention last year when he sold a large tract of family land in Yorkshire to a blind trust. Someone had gone to considerable lengths to conceal the identity of the buyer from the public view."
Sparks paused, watching Doyle's confusion with amused interest.
"The man who purchased Lady Nicholson's land was Brigadier General Charles Macaulay Drummond."
When they reached Faversham, waiting for them on the ridge above, was Barry, with a brougham and a brace of fresh horses. Larry bid Doyle a friendly farewell. He was leaving on some undisclosed assignment.
"How's your weekend etiquette?" asked Sparks.
"My what?"
"Houseguest skills, billiards, table talk, all that rubbish. We're visiting a gentleman's country house for New Year's Eve weekend, Doyle. I'm trying to ascertain your aptitude for the upper crust."
"Well, I know which fork to use, if that's what you mean," said Doyle, his ears burning with pride.
"Don't take offense, old boy. I need to determine which part you're going to play. The less suspicion we arouse among Lord Nicholson and his posh crowd, the better."
"What are my choices?"
"Master or manservant," said Sparks, throwing open a trunk to reveal its 2 halves packed with wardrobe appropriate to either role. "Baron Everett Gascoigne Pouge and valet, RSVP," Sparks said, producing an invitation to the year's end party and handing Doyle the working class clothes.
"But, Jack,
Don't you think they'll see right through this charade? They may not have a clear idea of your appearance, but they certainly know what I look like.
Sparks rummaged around in the trunk and pulled out a razor. We'll have Barry pull over so you don't endanger your sense of smell. Doyle's fingers flew protectively to his mustache. The gray dawn of New Year's Eve found them entering an arched gate and making the approach to Topping Manor down a straight and narrow lane lined with stately oaks, their branches reaching out to form a craggy canopy. The rows of oaks ended abruptly where Barry had brought them to a halt. Every tree from that point forward had been felled, stumps scorched and blasted, and all ground cover burned. Rising abruptly out of the torched flatland before them was a solid wall 30 feet high, makeshift, unbalanced, constructed from the untrimmed bodies of the downed trees, coarsely mortared with rocks, bricks, straw, dead grass, and wattles. The wall appeared to entirely enclose the manor house and grounds inside, but a quarter mile to the right, a rough passage was hacked through the barrier, a head taller than a man and twice as wide. Wood chips covered the ground, mostly outside the entrance. A weathered axe lay on the ground nearby. Gazing through the opening, they could see the house beyond. There was no sight or sound of activity inside. Sparks slid his rapier from his walking stick and ventured through the hollow. Doyle drew his revolver and joined him. The grounds, once clearly immaculate and groomed, were a ruin. Hedges crushed, statuary toppled, grass trampled and slashed. Ground floor windows had been barricaded from inside the house. Some windows were broken, glass fallen to the inside. Every door they tried was locked and immovable. Barry pointed to the rooftop of the manor. A thin ribbon of smoke issued from the tallest chimney. He ran ahead and leaped onto the front of the house, grabbed purchase for hand and foot in the margins between bricks, and scampered up to the second floor with the ease of a spider on a web. Pulling a jemmy stick from his coat, within seconds he persuaded the window to yield, pushed it open, and poured himself through to the interior.
"Just be a moment now," Sparks said.
They heard movement on the other side of the door, then a lock disengaging. A moment later, Barry opened the front door, and they entered, Topping. Tables and chairs had been stacked and jumbled against the door, which Barry now had the good sense to lock again behind them.
"Yes, I'd say the party is definitely off," said Sparks.
"There's a gent upstairs in a hall," Barry said unobtrusively.
"What was he doing?" asked Doyle.
"Looks like he was polishing the silver."
"Why don't you have a look around down here, Barry?" said Sparks as he started upstairs, two at a time.
Doyle ran up to join him. They moved into a rambling hall. At the far end, a candle was burning. As they moved closer, they saw on a three-legged stool a pear-shaped, balding hulk of a man, middle-aged, pasty, and hollow-eyed. Laid out before him was a silver service, full settings for 40, set in precisely measured rows.
"Hello," said Sparks.
The man froze without looking up. Tears sprang from his eyes.
"What's your name, my good man?" Sparks asked gently.
"Ruskin, sir,"
the man replied.
"Is the master here in the house?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Ruskin with an exhausted sigh.
"He hasn't been well lately, not well at all."
"Perhaps it would set your mind at rest if Dr. Doyle here were to have a consultation with him, if you'll direct us to the master's chambers," said Sparks.
"Far end of the hall, last door on your right."
"Thank you, Ruskin. The silver looks splendid."
They negotiated their way to the end of the hall, outside of what Ruskin had described as the master's doorway. The air was shattered by a loud crash of breaking crockery and an angry holler from inside the room. Sparks knocked on the door.
"Everything all right, sir?"
asked Sparks in an uncannily accurate rendering of Ruskin.
"Go away! Go away and play trains!"
Sparks continued with the guys.
"But some of the guests have arrived, sir."
"Guests? The guests have arrived?"
the voice trumpeted with equal measures of incredulity and contempt. Footsteps moved to the door inside. A series of bolts were thrown.
"If there's one thing I can't bear, you gelatinous cur," the voice said, rising in pitch and volume, "it's the squalid perpetuation of lies."
The door was pulled open, and they were confronted by a man of average height and build, with a wild nimbus of matted blonde beard and hair that had known no recent acquaintance of brush or comb. He wore a black silk dressing gown over a loose blouse, peculiar cork-soled boots and jodhpurs, and he was holding a double-barreled shotgun half a foot from their faces.
"Lord Nicholson, I presume,"
Sparks said, as pleasant and collected as a missionary on call.
"You're not Ruskin,"
Nicholson said with conviction.
"Baron Evryn Gascoigne Pouge,"
Sparks said, affecting the diffident accents of a jaded dandy as he produced the New Year's Eve invitation.
"Really? How odd. Well, quite all right. Come in, come in. Delighted,"
said Nicholson, lowering the gun, instantly the exuberant host.
"The bag's gone, Pertz,"
Sparks snapped at Doyle, who realized with a jolt he was suddenly required to perform the functions of his assigned role. "Right away, sir," Doyle said. Doyle brought his bag, the only bag they carried, through the door, which Nicholson quickly closed and bolted behind them. There were at least 6 locking devices, all of which he engaged. Heavy curtains were drawn in the high-ceilinged room, broadening the somber mood set by ponderous medieval furnishings. The floor was littered with broken cups and plates and the remains of old meals.
"How about some brandy?"
Nicholson asked, plucking the stopper from a cut crystal decanter and sloppily filling 2 tumblers without waiting for a reply. He greedily gulped down half a ration and poured a refill before conveying the 2nd glass to Sparks.
"Cheers, then."
"Thank you ever so,"
said Sparks, disinterestedly making himself comfortable in front of the fire. Nicholson sat on the edge of his chair, eyes wide with enthusiasm, took another sloppy drink, and wiped his moist lips with his sleeve.
"Do you see my boots?"
He held up his dressing gown like a dance hall coquette.
"Cork-soled. They do not conduct electricity. 3 pairs of socks, no, sir. No electrocution for me, even if it will make the trains run faster. Ha, ha!"
Sparks demonstrated the wherewithal to recognize this as a remark to which there was no proper response.
"How is your father, the Earl?" asked Sparks.
"Still alive,"
said Nicholson, as if it were the funniest thing imaginable.
"Ha, ha! Clinging to life, the mean bastard! No title for young Charles here, living on a pittance, tied to the old man's purse strings. Spite in his veins, spite in ice water and horse piss. And why isn't he dead yet?"
In a paroxysm of wrath, Nicholson flung his tumbler into the fireplace and jumped repeatedly up and down, spinning and screaming in the grip of an infantile frenzy. Doyle and Sparks stole a look that wondered just how hazardous a lunatic the man was. Then, just as suddenly as he'd begun raving, Nicholson snapped out of his fit and strode to the mantel for another tumbler, which he calmly filled, all the while gaily singing a chorus from the latest Gilbert and Sullivan.
"And how's your wife?" Sparks asked.
Nicholson stopped humming, his back to them.
"Lady Nicholson, how is she?"
"My wife?"
Nicholson said coldly.
"That's right. I saw her recently in London. She wasn't looking very well. Perhaps she was worried about your son."
Nicholson turned back to Sparks. He was holding a pistol. His lips curled in a malicious smile.
"Who are you?"
Nicholson asked.
"My wife sent you. You're her lover, aren't you? The filthy whore!"
"Put that gun down, you stupid boy," shouted Sparks with ringing authority. Nicholson froze like a dog hearing a whistle above the range of human hearing. The twisted smile melted off his face, revealing the bereft, self-pitying mask of an unloved child. He lowered the gun. Sparks rose quickly, snatched the gun from Nicholson's hand, and slapped him 2 hard across the face. Nicholson crumpled to his knees and began to weep like a baby. "If you ever speak rudely to me again," Sparks said intently, "or speak of your wife rudely, or make any crude remarks on any subject whatsoever while in my presence, you will be very severely punished. Do I make myself clear, boy?"
You can't speak to me that way,"
Nicholson sniffled. Sparks shoved him into a chair. "Where is your wife?" Sparks asked.
"London. London, I think. I haven't seen her in 3 months."
"Where is your son?"
"She took him."
"Why did you build the wall, Charlie?"
"Because I'm afraid of her. She worships Satan and she consorts with devils. She makes the bad things come."
"What sort of bad things are they?"
"I don't know. I've never seen them."
"You sold some land in the north to a man, General Drummond."
"The general came here. He came with my wife."
The General is a friend of your wife's, is he?
Yes, yes, they're good friends. The General's a nice man. He brings me sweets and caramels. He brought me a pony once.
Nicholson babbled, retreating farther into childhood. And immediately after you signed the papers, that's when your wife left you, isn't it? She left with the General.
Yes, sir.
How long were you married?
4 years.
Did she ever tell you anything about her family?
She said her family owned a publishing company.
In London? Doyle asked involuntarily.
Yes, across from the big museum.
Russell Street? Nicholson nodded. There was a loud hammering at the door. Out the window! Shouted Barry from the hallway. Sparks moved to the window and drew the curtain. Doyle joined him. The figure in black from the inn at Cambridge was moving across the courtyard towards the front door, a half-dozen grey hoods behind him.
"We're going to leave you now, Charles," said Sparks. "Load your gun. Lock the door after us."
Working together, Sparks and Doyle had the locks undone in moments, and they moved out to join Barry in the hall and ran down the stairs. A heavy pounding began at the door. Windows shattered all along the front wall. An arm groped through an opening, a hand looking for a latch. Barry led them to the kitchen and into the adjacent larder. He pulled a sack of flour off a shelf. The opposite wall rose up and disappeared into the ceiling, revealing the mysterious door.
"Got a lock on it you won't find in some banks," said Barry, as he unfolded a cache of his tools and went to work on the formidable padlock.
A crash from somewhere deep in the house announced the invaders had breached the outer fortifications.
"Give me a hand here, Doyle," said Sparks, pushing a table against the kitchen door.
They piled the rest of the room's furniture on top of the table. The thwack of Barry driving a spike into the lock resounded in the small space like a gunshot, and he pushed the door open. The smell that greeted them was dank, ageless, and as stale as the grave. Sparks took the lead, and they went down the first few steps. Carved right out of the earth, they were steep, slippery with moss, and crudely crafted.
"Got a lantern here?"
said Barry, plucking an oil lamp off a hook on the earthen wall.
"Pull that knob by the jamb, Doctor," said Barry.
Doyle gave the knob a yank. The false wall slid smoothly back down into the larder. Doyle shut the door and laid across it a welcomely substantial iron bar. The stairs seemed to go on interminably. Sheer drop-offs into darkness fell away to either side, a vast cavern opening up around them. Sparks crashed into a solid obstruction. Doyle reached out and put his hands on the object. It was rounded, cold and smooth, with machined edges, and it was massive.
It's a train, he said.
A sterling single, said Barry. A real beauty.
They climbed into the engine cab. Gauges and pumps were intact and seemed in working order.
I'd venture to say we have Lord Nicholson's in delicate condition to thank for this good fortune, said Sparks. Know anything about piloting a train?
Light the coal in the firebox, for starters, said Barry.
The rhythmic shush of the steam valves echoed through the chamber like the breathing cycle of an enormous slumbering beast. Barry threw down the hammer. The pistons spasmed twice and then caught steel on steel. With the protesting shriek and groan of rusty muscles, the wheels inched slowly forward on the tracks.
Lady Nicholson was a Confederate all along, said Doyle, much as it pained him to think poorly of the woman.
A possibility, although we can't know what sort of coercion they brought to bear on her.
On the other hand, said Doyle, remembering the light in her deep blue eyes, all we have to support the idea she was in league with them are the semi-coherent ravings of a deranged and jilted husband.
There's a light up ahead, Barry announced.
Moments later, the train broke free of the confines of the earth and spirited them into the open air. The tracks hugged the slope of a sheer ravine, a river running swiftly below. In the distance behind them, up a steep slope and above the trees, peered the machicolations of Topping's highest towers. Thick, quarrelsome pillars of black smoke spewed around them.
They've put a torch to it, said Barry in dismay. All that silver.
Maybe they think we're trapped inside, said Doyle. If they believe we're dead, they'll slacken off the chase.
He would see me quartered and then watch the body burn before making such an assumption, said Sparks grimly.
Who is he, Jack? Doyle asked quietly. The man in black. You know him, don't you?
He's my brother, said Sparks.
Barry displayed an intimate knowledge of the spidery network of tracks that laced the Kent and Sussex countryside, switching them away from primary routes onto the seldom-used freight lines. When they finally pulled into a private yard in Battersea, night had firmly fallen. Leaving Barry to secure the engine's harbor, Sparks and Doyle walked to a nearby busy thoroughfare and hailed a hansom cab, which deposited them in the center of the Strand, one of London's liveliest avenues, never busier than on this moonlit New Year's Eve. A dingy awning announced a not particularly inviting lodging as the Hotel Melwyn. Sparks paid cash for two adjoining rooms. Baths were requested for both men and inestimably enjoyed in a communal chamber at the far end of the hall. As he emerged from the bath, for the first time since shedding his mustache, Doyle caught sight of himself in a mirror. Add the cosmetic wire-rimmed glasses Sparks had lent him from his bag of tricks, plus the valet's haircut Barry had administered, and Doyle had to look twice to be certain it was his own face. Heartened by the substantial changes wrought in his appearance, scrubbed, shaved, and the first to return to his room, Doyle was surprised to discover unfamiliar luggage near the door, fresh evening clothes laid out on the bed, and the esteemed Larry, brother of Barry, lighting a fire in the hearth.
"You've been busy, I see, Larry," said Sparks, toweling off as he re-entered the room. "What about our dinner?"
9:30 at the Criterion. Oysters on the off-shell. Lobsters on the boil. Gay and frisky in a bottle of whiskey. They're expecting you."
They finished dressing and presented themselves at the revered doors of the Criterion Long Bar. Their elegant evening wear rendered them invisible among the flood tide of swells frequenting the dining room, the perfect camouflage on this most festive of London nights. Many was the time that Doyle, the beleaguered medical student, had pressed his nose to the windows outside, but never had he crossed over that storied threshold. Sparks was well known to the maitre d'. Chilled champagne awaited them, a platoon of attentive captains and waiters standing by to assure that their glasses never emptied. A sumptuous, gout-giving succession of mouth-watering comestibles proceeded to rain down on them like the fortuitous bounty of a culinary god. Doyle scarcely had breath to speak between bites and gulps, throwing himself into the consumption of the feast with bacchanalian abandon. The champagne carbonated the shadow of doom that had dogged their last few days and effervesced it to oblivion. Around them, the room seemed impossibly lithe and gay and filled with light. Women glowed with Athenian glamour. The men were fortified with some Herculean ideal. The last dishes were cleared away. Sparks lit a cheroot and warmed the honey nectar of his brandy over a candle.
"So," he said, gaveling the proceedings back to order, "as to my brother."
Doyle had not expected him to open with that trump card, but he was more than willing to accept candor from the man as he found it.
"Do you find it as troubling as I that the corpus of human hope is pegged so directly to the concept of our social progress?" asked Sparks.
What this non-sequitorial tack had to do with his brother, well, Doyle had waited out far more torturous tangents than this.
"The instinct to survive," said Sparks. "Ensuring the survival of the strong, as in nature, Doyle. A fight for air, light, for strong, attractive mating partners, for space or food. Dominion, domination. Material greed, the root of human conflict. It's inescapable. Man is compelled to obey the instinct to dominate because of our unconscious imperative to survive. It overrides every other biological impulse. Compassion, sympathy, love, any of the niceties sacred to the privileged lives in this room."
"A paradox, then," said Doyle.
"Does man's will to live present the single greatest danger to our survival?" "If human nature does not soon demonstrate the ability to willfully change its course, I submit to you that it does," said Sparks, leaning forward, holding Doyle taut in his gaze. "I offer in evidence the life of one Alexander Bartholomew Sparks, born to wealthy parents, a beloved first child, indulged and cosseted through early childhood by every creature comfort known to man. Quite independent of these influences, the boy soon demonstrates a remarkably headstrong native character, an intellect of cold and calculating genius. With his father stationed half a world away on diplomatic assignment, the child's mother, a celebrated beauty, dotes slavishly on her boy.
He comes to perceive himself as God's chosen one, an infant sun king with absolute power. Then one day, in his fifth summer, the adored and loving mother of the king disappears from sight. Even the boy's tempestuous rages are not sufficient to effect her reappearance. When he is once again allowed access to her bedchamber, he discovers, to his astonishment and horror, that in her arms lies a hideous usurper.
"You?" asked Doyle quietly.
"A sister." Not long after, late one night, he creeps silently into his mother's chambers. She is in bed, sound asleep. The monster lies in a cradle. He picks up a small satin pillow and puts it over the thing's face, and he holds it there until the creature stops kicking its arms and legs and lies still. As it dies, the mother awakes with a scream. The Sun King flees from the room. He is sure she has seen him. Her mind comes undone. A heart-stopping wail shakes the very walls of the house. As the boy lies quaking in his bed, his mother's cries give him more pleasure than 1,000 kisses. A week passes, and his father returns from his distant overseas post. It is suspicion with which the man searches the young king's eyes. So she did see him in the chamber. The king shows his father nothing, no remorse, weakness, or human feeling, and sees something replace suspicion in his father's eyes. Fear. The king knows the father will never challenge his authority again. After the funeral, his mother never again looks upon him with the loving gaze that had been her custom before the pretender came. The following summer, the woman discovers she is once again with child. The news is kept from the boy, but as a precaution, Alexander is packed up and sent away to boarding school. The next spring, a second son is born. Yes, Doyle. My entrance onto the stage. Not for years was he even aware of my presence, nor I of his. Alexander stayed at school through terms and all the holidays. My parents paid a visit every Easter week. Finally, they admitted his existence to me, but I was never to write or to accept letters from him. I would never be alone in his company. We paid an Easter visit to my brother's public school when I was 7. Alexander was 12. He was a striking boy, tall, sturdy, with black hair and riveting eyes. He seemed to me the soul of comradeship. As we walked back from dinner, Alexander pulled me from view and pressed a note into my hand, urging me to conceal it from my parents. Along with it, he gave me a black, polished stone, a talisman, which he assured me was his most treasured possession.
What did the letter say?
Innocent schoolboy chat. Nothing overt that would have upset my parents if they'd ever found it. He ended with instructions on how I might write him back. I was to address the letter to a classmate of his. A fiercely devoted cadre of boys had served him unswervingly since his arrival. I wrote him back at once. He had recruited one of his cousins to bicycle out to our estate and leave his letters in a biscuit tin I had buried near an ancient oak, well out of sight of the main house. So my correspondence with my brother began. It was from the start voluminous, the contents academically vigorous and far-reaching. His command of history, philosophy, art, and science was prodigious. Alexander had polished himself to shine every bit as supremely dazzling in the social graces as he was natively in the academic. He followed a brutally rigorous regimen of exercises. By the time he was 13, Alexander was frequently mistaken for a man of 20. He portrayed himself as the avatar of self-perfection, the first of a new breed, the superior man. I embraced his guidelines for self-improvement. I wholeheartedly intended to recreate myself in his image. Not at all to your detriment. By no means. The developments and skills he outlined have been in and of themselves supremely beneficial. But having once achieved them, to the pursuit of what ends these advances were to be employed, my brother never went so far to say.
What was his purpose, Jack?
There were no signs. Accidents. One of the boys in Alexander's class died mysteriously. They raised honeybees on the campus, part of a science study course. The boy was found stung to death.
No one knew that the boy had balked at one of Alexander's imperious commands, threatening to leave his circle of intimates and expose their secrets.
What sort of secrets?
Blood oaths, violent hazing of new schoolboys admitted to the group, torture of small animals. Doyle shook his head in wonder. There's more. In that fall of Alexander's 12th year, in the town near the school, a number of young women reported that they felt they were being followed. Some thought they were being watched inside their bedrooms. They never saw a face, only a dark shape dressed all in black. One night, in early April, the town's comeliest young woman was assaulted near the banks of the river. Sexually assaulted, she was beaten savagely. She could only identify him as a black shape.
Huh, your brother, of course.
Sparks nodded. This attack occurred, by the way, 2 days before my meeting him. The polished black rock he gave me was taken from the riverbed where the girl was violated. His trophy of the conquest. A much ballyhooed search of the countryside for the assailant, of course, yielded nothing. As he entered his last year of school before university, and I neared the age and size he'd been when we first met, his letters stopped without warning. I felt as if a limb had been cut from my body. I counted the days and hours until that Easter when Alexander and I would be reunited. When we finally did meet, Alexander was as pleasant and convivial with me as always. Once again on the walk through the gardens after dinner, his words to me were few, but they were resonant with that conspiratorial tone of affiliation that I had longed all these months to hear. See your way clear to Europe this summer, in July, alone. He suggested Salzburg, famous for its music academy. Immediately upon our return home, I threw myself into what had up until that point been at best my desultory efforts to master the violin. I let mention that I had heard of a musical conservatory in Austria, and my parents presented the idea of my enrolling at that very academy for the coming summer. The next day I wrote Alexander one cryptic sentence. The job is done. I received no reply. In the middle of June, I arrived in Austria, where I busied myself in my studies and waited for word from Alexander. The dance floor was by this time filled with revelers. The orchestra began to assay the sentimental favorites of the day. In the second week of July, I was called out of my private instruction and taken to the headmaster's office. As the last seconds of the dying year dwindled away, the crowd began a countdown. 10, 9, 8...
You will have to return to England immediately, the headmaster told me. There's been a fire.
7, 6, 5...
Are my parents dead?
4, 3, 2...
Yes, John.
The countdown ended, and the room erupted cacophonously. Streamers swirled through the air, noisemakers ratcheted, lovers kissed, strangers embraced, the band played on. Without another word, Sparks rose from his seat, threw a pack of pound notes down on the table, and sliced through the crowd towards the door. Doyle followed, pushing through the mad clamor onto the street. They walked down a side street away from the crowds. Across the Thames, a fireworks display threw vibrant sparklers into the air, reflecting darkly on the black, gelid waters.
The house was simply gone. Ashes.
Were the bodies?
My mother's was never recovered. My father had somehow got out of the house. They found him near the stables, burned beyond recognition. He hung on to life for nearly a day, asking for me. Near the end, he dictated a letter to his priest, a letter for me. Father wrote to tell me that I had once had a sister who lived for 53 days. My brother Alexander had murdered the girl in her cradle. This was why they'd kept us apart, and he implored me with his last breath to forsake my brother's company forever. There had been something wrong in Alexander from the beginning, something not human. His mind was as glittering and as false as a black diamond.
Sparks paused, steeling himself, before carrying Doyle the last few steps into the core of his nightmare.
On the night they died, my father retired early to his rooms. He read for a while, then fell asleep before the fire. My mother's voice woke him, crying out in pain. Going to her chamber, he discovered her bound hand and foot to the posts of the bed.
He was struck from behind and fell unconscious. When he regained his senses, he was tied securely to a chair. My mother was on the bed as before. A figure was on top of her, assaulting her intimately. A figure all in black. She was screaming as if she had lost her mind. The figure completed the loathsome act and turned and smiled, and my father was greeted by the face of his oldest son. Sparks exhaled heavily. He slumped slightly forward, his face in the shadows.
There is evil loose in the world. I had dwelled in its shadow. It flourished in a body and soul that entered into life through the same passage I had taken. I had willingly allowed myself to be consciously molded by its bearer into his own image. What if the same vile, twisted spirit that drove him to these unspeakable crimes was alive in me? I was 12 years old.
Doyle could offer his friend no comfort other than his silent, heartfelt tears.
I had to believe that the skills my brother instilled in me I had learned for a purpose, Sparks said, throaty with determination. I had to believe that there could be more than one sort of superior man. Justice would be my North Star, not mendacity and deluded self-worship. I would deliver into this world a force to counter the darkness to which my brother had succumbed. That was my mission, to stand opposed, to set myself in his way, to become his nemesis.
His words revived the faltering pulse of hope in Doyle's chest. They stood in silence for a time and watched the river. Entering the hotel by a discreet rear entrance, they settled into their rooms, lit a fire, and broke open a bottle of cognac.
"When were you next aware of his hand at work?" asked Doyle, breaking the long silence.
"He left England, spent time in Paris, then drifted south. He arrived in Cairo less than a year after the killings. His first task was the amassing of capital towards financial independence. Before setting the fire, he stole from my father's collection of Egyptiana the most priceless treasures. He went to Cairo to peddle them."
"Other crimes were committed as well?" Doyle surmised.
"There were a series of distinctive murders that year in Cairo. My father kept a mistress there, a colleague in the Foreign Service. Soon after Alexander arrived, she disappeared. A week later, her head was found in the souk, the marketplace. Beheading is customary with adulteresses in Muslim cultures, which naturally threw suspicion towards a local. The following week, he dispatched a prominent art dealer, an Egyptian man, along with his wife and children. My conclusion, the man extended negotiations on a piece of my father's collection beyond the limits of Alexander's patience. The item in question, a ceremonial dagger, was the murder weapon. There had been a spate of hysteria in Cairo about the curse of the mummy's tomb from whence this dagger and a number of other items in the dealer's possession had been plundered. Alexander had cut out the dealer's heart. They discovered the missing organ beside the body, in a ceremonial bowl covered with the ashes of tanis leaves, believed to be the key ingredient in the ritual formulated by the priests of the pharaohs for resurrection from the mummified state. Can you detect the touch of Alexander in all of this?"
"Yes," said Doyle, remembering the death of the London streetwalker.
"Alexander was developing an interest in the occult. As his mastery of the physical world grew more accomplished, his interest moved naturally towards magic and the immaterial plane. From what I was able to reconstruct, the next few years he drifted throughout the Middle East, seeking entrance to various mystery schools, Zoroastrians, the Sufis, Hashishims, assassins, the murderous cult of the Old Man of the Mountain.
But they were eradicated centuries ago."
"Some highly placed Turks will tell you that small sects of devotees have survived in Syria and Iran, secreted in remote mountain freeholds."
"When did Alexander return to Britain?"
"My best estimate, 12 years ago, not long after I actively began my career."
"How did you know he'd returned?"
Sparks stared intently into the fire.
"I had for many years been aware of, call it a directing intelligence behind the activities of London's criminal community. As you know, I have recruited a number of these denizens, rehabilitating them in the process, one hopes.
Many can speak to rumors of an overlord sitting at the hub of the city's wheel of vice, gambling, slavery, hijacking, smuggling, prostitution, the fruits of these crimes flowing always towards the center.
Now it was Doyle's turn to stare deeply into the fire and wonder if the new year the crowds outside had ushered in would be his last. Doyle woke from a fitful dream that fled before him to find Sparks at the table poring over a map of London. It was 5:30, dawn hardly a rumor in the sky outside. He wiped the grit from his eyes. It took the entire pot of coffee and a tray of cakes Larry had brought in for Doyle to strip the rust from his muscles and brain.
"Well, there are a dozen publishers on Russell Street within walking distance of the museum," said Sparks, energetically handing him a list.
There were two firms Doyle recognized. The first had rejected and returned his opus. The second was the last he'd sent the damn thing to.
"Then, that's where we will begin," said Sparks, and he was out the door. Doyle grabbed the last cake from the platter and hurried after him.
"Found a bloke you should have a bash at," said Barry. "Aussie bloke, boxer. Claims he once had the acquaintance of Mr. Lansdowne Dilks."
"Doyle, go with Barry," said Sparks. He jumped aboard a small hansom with Larry at the reins, and they pulled away.
Barry led Doyle briskly through the maze of Covent Garden, where in the stalls of the vegetable and flower sellers, the commerce of the new year was off to a bustling beginning. The trail took them to a gymnasium in a Soho side street. Inside, a boisterous knot of wrestlers knuckled around a cutthroat game of dice. Barry waded in to separate the object of their query from the pack. He returned a minute later with a flat-faced, hulking mass of hardened flesh.
"I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Bodger Nuggins."
Doyle accepted the behemoth's two-handed handshake.
"Tell the gentleman what you told me, Bodger," prompted Barry.
"Did you know Mr. Lansdowne Dilks?" asked Doyle.
"A hard moke," confirmed Bodger.
"You served your sentences together until the execution of Dilks' sentence?"
"Dilks looked in the pink last time the Bodger clapped eyes on him."
"And when was that, pray?"
"When we got off the train together up north. Yorkshire-like. So happens the Bodger remembers the exactical date, seeing as how it was his own birthday, March the 4th.
"Are you telling me that you and Dilks took a train to Yorkshire a month after he swung and years before your sentence was due to expire?"
"Right. Lansdowne and me and the others what signed on."
"Signed on how?"
"With the bloke what come round the prison."
"Can you describe him?"
Bodger rolled his eyes skyward. "Beard, glasses."
"What were you signing to do?"
"Get out of prison."
"In exchange for what?" The air was shattered by a piercing chorus of police whistles. The men in the dice game scattered. Bodger turned tail and sprinted for the dressing room. The front doors burst open, and a squadron of bobbies, batons raised, rushed into the gym. The first blow caught Doyle along the side of the head. Barry's concerned face was the first sight that greeted Doyle when he opened his eyes.
"Quite the cue ball you're cultivating there."
Doyle raised a hand to the blood-pounding sight on his forehead and found a swollen goose egg residing there. He was in a large common holding cell shared by a milling mix of roughnecks and reprobates. The room was filthy and reeked to high heaven. Roaches the size of thumbs scuttled fearlessly around the margins and over the boots of men who seemed all too accustomed to their company.
Where's Bodger?"
"Bodger Nuggins is not among our number," said Barry.
"They can't very well hold us here if they don't charge us with a crime."
"This is your first time, isn't it?"
asked Barry with a subtle smile. Doyle searched in his pockets and fished out his physician's prescription notepad and pencil and scrawled out a hasty message, then took a 10-pound note from Barry and tore it neatly in half, folded the written note around it, and handed it to an officer. "Half now, and the rest when we get word the message has been received." Barry couldn't help but notice the note was addressed to Inspector Claude Lebeau. 2 hours later, Doyle was summarily escorted without explanation to a small room set aside for the questioning of suspects. Minutes afterwards, Lebeau appeared alone, his mustache fairly bristling with anger.
"Corralled at a dice game, Arthur?"
Trying to heed Spark's repeated advice about mistrusting police, Doyle weighed how much he needed to divulge in order to secure his release. "There have been repeated attempts on my life by the identical parties who tried the other day."
"Why haven't you come to me?"
"I've been out of the city since you last saw me," said Doyle. "Leaving London seemed the safest course."
"Was it?"
"No, as it happens. These assailants have pursued me relentlessly."
"When did you return, Arthur?"
"Last night."
"Have you been to your flat?"
Petrovich, thought Doyle. He knows about Petrovich. "I haven't, Claude. I wasn't at all sure it would be safe."
"Your building was burned down," LeBeau finally said.
"My flat?" Doyle shook his head. Fire again. Not hard to reason who's responsible for that, thought Doyle. "Claude, are you familiar with the name Alexander Sparks?" LeBeau shook his head slightly. "That's the man who's after me, the man responsible for these crimes, and perhaps a great many others as well."
"What's his appearance?"
"I've never seen his face. He's given to wearing black and a cape, a black cape."
LeBeau's cheeks filled with color. "Do you happen to know his hat size?"
"You don't believe me. What about what I found on the floorboards at 13 Cheshire Street?"
"Yes, I had that substance analyzed by our chemist. It does appear that you did, in fact, witness a murder."
"Just as I told you."
"The murder of a large hog. It was pig's blood, Arthur. Perhaps someone got carried away carving the Sunday roast."
Feeling the leverage of LeBeau's scrutiny, Doyle was prompted out onto an even less sturdy part of the limb to which he was so precariously clinging. "John Sparks," he said, almost a whisper. "Does the name ring a bell?" LeBeau paused.
"Perhaps."
"He tells me he's in the service of the Queen," whispered Doyle. That brought LeBeau to a momentary halt.
"What am I to do with this piece of information?"
Perhaps you could verify it." Doyle could feel his bond with LeBeau stretch to its breaking point.
"My strong advice to you is stay in London," said LeBeau.
"Am I free to go then?"
"Yes. I need to know how to reach you."
"Leave word at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. I'll make a point of checking there on a daily basis."
"See that you do."
"One more name, Claude. A Mr. Bodger Nuggins. He was at the dice game, but apparently wasn't apprehended along with..."
"We pulled Mr. Bodger Nuggins from the Thames about an hour ago."
"Drowned?"
"His throat was slashed, like he'd been attacked by an animal."
It was a long walk from Pentonville Prison to the center of London. Doyle hadn't judged it prudent to press LeBeau for Barry's release. A cab pulled up beside him. Sparks threw open the passenger door.
"Come along, Doyle," he said.
Larry whipped the horse and drove the hansom due east on Oxford to an address on Montague, directly across from the British Museum, number 26, a whitewashed, well-kept, but otherwise nondescript Georgian townhouse. Inside, shades were drawn. Doyle doubted they were ever opened, so close and musky was the air, and every inch of available wall lined with bulging bookshelves. A stack of index cabinets filled one corner.
"Not a first-rate idea, Doyle, seeking out Inspector LeBeau for the second time," said Sparks.
"I saw it as my foremost obligation to obtain the quickest possible release," said Doyle testily. "I trust LeBeau implicitly."
"You spent 2 hours in a cell chock-a-block full with an honor roll of London lowlife and made a grand show of buying your way out. Do you imagine some word of your performance hasn't filtered back up the vine?"
Doyle sniffled and snorted. "What about Barry?"
"Don't you worry none about Barry, Gov," said Larry. "Many's the worst scrapes he's shimmied out of before."
"Well, at least we found Bodger Nuggins," said Doyle defensively.
Not a moment too soon, I'd say.
You can't very well hold me responsible for his death. When I last laid eyes on him, he was all but very firmly in the hands of the police.
Why do you suppose I persist in warning you against speaking to them?" said Sparks patiently.
Which implies, fantastically, that in addition to his alleged criminal empire, your brother holds some sway over Scotland Yard. A tall glass-front highboy caught Doyle's eye. It displayed a diverse collection of antique or exotic weaponry, from primitive Stone Age daggers to flintlock muskets to a cluster of octagonal silver stars. "What are these?" asked Doyle.
"Shinsku, the Japanese throwing stars. Absolutely deadly. Show Dr. Doyle the picture, Larry."
Larry produced a photograph from the pocket of his coat. It depicted a woman leaving the rear of a building down a flight of stairs towards a black coach in the lower left-hand corner of the frame. Doyle studied the photo closely.
"She looks somewhat like Lady Nicholson, but this woman is stronger somehow, physically larger as well. This is not the same woman. Where did you obtain this?"
"Why, we took it ourselves this morning. We happened to be concealed outside the rear of the Russell Street publishing house owned by Lady Nicholson's family. Now, gentlemen, let's be off. The hour is late, and we've got a full night of burglary and stealth ahead of us."
Montague Street was deserted by that time of night, and a fleecy mass of fog made subterfuge all the easier. Ducking through a cobbled alley, they arrived at the rear of the building. Larry skipped silently up the steps to the back door and completed the preliminaries. A moment later, he held the door as they slipped inside.
"Rathbone and Sons Limited," read Sparks. "Larry, why don't you keep an eye on the hall while we have a look inside?"
Rows of clerks' desks, sheaves of invoices, contracts, bills of lading. It seemed a neat and orderly concern.
"Let's think this through, Doyle. Rathbone would be Lady Caroline Nicholson's family or maiden name. One brother we know of, the late George B. of Cambridge. Other than that, nothing's available on the Rathbone family in public record. I've found no reference to Rathbone the elder whatsoever."
"That's odd."
"Perhaps not. This firm is 6 years old, hardly an enduring tradition passed down for generations."
They moved to a row of closed doors and found one with "President" emblazoned on the smoked glass window panel. Locked. Sparks handed the candle to Doyle, took a small set of twin picks from his pocket, and worked them into the keyhole.
"During my visit, I fingered a catalogue of their published works. The occult seemed to be the spécialité de maison, a trickle of legal publishing, hardly enough volume of trade to support such a well-appointed concern as this, and no fiction whatsoever," said Sparks, manipulating the picks like a pair of chopsticks.
A click was heard inside, and the door popped open. "So if they have no interest in fiction here, the question is, why wasn't the book simply returned to me straight off?"
"I suspect the title, The Dark Brotherhood, must have caught someone's eye."
Sparks produced a correspondence with masted letterhead from a desk drawer. The letter itself was a routine memorandum, but the list of company directors on the masthead was something else again. George B. Rathbone, President. Directors: Sir John Chandros, Brigadier General Marcus Drummond, Maximilian Graves, Sir Nigel Gull, Lady Rathbone Nicholson, The Honorable Bishop Caius Catullus Pilfrock, Professor Arminius Vamberg.
"First off, we're to believe that a callow 19-year-old student at Cambridge is the firm's principal executive? No. Lady Nicholson is the true power behind Rathbone and Sons.
Sir Nigel Gull used to be one of two physicians exclusive to the royal family," said Doyle.
"I believe his primary responsibility was tending to young Prince Albert. Who else do you recognize on this list, Doyle?"
"John Chandros, former Member of Parliament from a northern district."
"Wasn't Chandros involved in the prison reform movement? His name also surfaced in my investigation of the Nicholson-Drummond transaction. He owns a sizable freehold of land adjacent to the property sold by Nicholson to General Drummond. How Gull fits into this mesh, we have yet to discover."
"What of the others?"
"I am acquainted with the name of Bishop Pilfrock, Church of England. His diocese is North York."
"What is the common thread?" asked Sparks.
"Wealthy, powerful, prominent citizens.
four with ties to Yorkshire, where those convicts were allegedly sent, all united through a false business front. There is every reason to believe that what we have in our possession here is nothing less than a list of the Dark Brotherhood's innermost council. Seven names. Seven is a profane as well as a sacred number. Strikes me as a bit of a leap of faith, said Doyle, as a thin line of white under the blotter on the desk caught his eye. He lifted the blotter and pulled out a creased square of slick paper, unfolding it to reveal a poster advertising a theatrical troupe's appearance in London. The Revenger's Tragedy, read Doyle. The Manchester Players. I don't know them, but there are dozens of companies touring around Britain at any one time. More to the point, what was this doing here? Well, perhaps overwhelmed by his publishing responsibilities, young George liked to sit at his desk, dreaming of a carefree life on the stage, said Doyle. They were back on the street and quickly across it to Sparks' apartment, where they settled in for what little remained of the night. Before Doyle had roused himself from his death-like slumber, John Sparks had been out the door since dawn and returned from his morning's work to rouse the others and set them on their way. The three men slipped down the back staircase before noon and climbed aboard their hansom. Sparks' morning had been highly productive, he informed Doyle and Larry. Breakfast in the company of a former theatrical colleague had yielded the current whereabouts of the Manchester Players. On tour in the northeast of England, an engagement in Whitby. Whitby. York again. Wasn't that the parish where Bishop Pilfrock, one of the names on the list, tended his flock? Doyle inquired. Not only that, Sparks told them, Whitby was also the winter residence of Sir John Chandros, one of Pilfrock's prominent companions on the list of seven. Something has just struck me about one of the names, said Sparks. Maximilian Graves, an alias, a play on words. Do you see it? Makes a million graves. Precisely the sort of diseased jest Alexander used to play with obsessively in his letters. Beware of the inveterate punster, Doyle. It's a sure sign of brewing mental disturbance. For his final revelation, Sparks handed Doyle a slender, cloth-bound volume he had unearthed at Hatchard's bookshop. My Life Among the Himalayan Masters by Professor Arminius Vamberg. Vamberg, yet another name from the list. Look at the publisher, said Sparks. Doyle opened the front piece. Rathbone and Sons Limited. No picture of him, said Doyle. I'll wager he has a beard, said Sparks cryptically. A beard? The man who obtained Bodger Nuggins' release from Newgate was described to you as having a beard. Study it at your leisure, Doctor. We've a long train ride ahead of us. To Whitby, I assume. But of course, said Sparks. As they snaked through the crowded noontime streets, Doyle was jolted by the memory of his promise to Le Beau not to take leave of London again without leaving word. He asked Sparks if they might quickly stop by St. Bartholomew's Hospital on the way. He wished to secure some of the few personal effects he kept there, and, since they were heading into the possibility of more and greater danger, replenish his stock of medical supplies as well. Returning Sparks' subtly questioning gaze with impassive stolidity, Doyle felt reasonably confident he hadn't betrayed his true intention. St. Bartholomew's Hospital, Larry, Sparks instructed. Reaching the hospital, Sparks joined Doyle as he left the carriage. Can't very well ask him not to come, thought Doyle. How would that look? Sparks sat on a bench outside the physician's quarters to wait while he requisitioned the supplies he needed and checked his locker. After receiving the additional medical supplies from the disbursement office, Doyle walked back to the door. Sparks was no longer on the bench. Doyle quickly walked to the reception desk, grabbed a pen, and was about to hastily scribble a note to Le Beau when the nurse on duty noticed him. "Oh, Dr. Doyle, I've a message here for you," she said, and handed him an envelope. "Thank you," said Doyle. He opened it. "Arthur, Mr. John Sparks is an escaped lunatic from the asylum at Bedlam. Violent and extremely dangerous. Contact me immediately. Le Beau." "Some secret paramour?" said Sparks. "What?" Doyle looked up, startled. Sparks was beside him, leaning on the desk. "The letter, old boy. Is it from a lover?"
An old acquaintance wants me for a game of squash, said Doyle, folding and returning it to the nurse as casually as nature would allow. Please let the gentleman know I shall be unavailable to play for the next week or so.
Very good, doctor, said the nurse.
Doyle picked up his bag and started out. Sparks fell into step beside him.
Good God! Is it all lies? Everything he's told me?
You all right, Doyle? Asked Sparks evenly.
Couldn't say there's not a lot on my mind, could I?
A cry from the door of the ward they were passing interrupted an extended scream, high-pitched and agonized. A child's voice. Doyle turned and looked inside. A shambling red-nosed clown had just left off playing a hurdy-gurdy organ and was crowding in behind a quartet of nurses attempting to calm the child whose ululating outburst had stilled the room.
Black Lord!
Doyle thought he heard the boy wail. The child's eyes had rolled back into his head. His arms thrashed about as his entire body jerked in fitful spasms. The white-faced clown pushed forward.
What's wrong with him?
Doyle checked the boy's pulse. His heart was racing, his pupils wildly dilated.
Black Lord! Black Lord!
His words were becoming clearer. Sparks took Doyle by the arm, directing him back into and through the chaotic scene around them towards the door. They made for the north, a straight course out of London. Doyle sat uneasily across from Sparks as they drove. Who do I believe? Doyle was forced to ask himself. A lunatic from Bedlam? Was it possible? A man tormented by imagined persecutors? Living in a shadowy world of secret connections to high places, no less than the Queen? But Sparks always seemed so lucid, so supremely rational. Even lunatics were capable of sustained lucidity. A darker question suddenly loomed behind these worrisome speculations. What if there was no Alexander Sparks? Was it possible this man was himself the criminal mastermind he had described his brother to be? What if this brooding puzzle of a man seated across from him embodied both brothers at once, fragmented selves residing in the troubled crucible of a single imagination, each believing the other as separate and autonomous, one stalking and killing at will, the other haunted by a memory of foul deeds committed in the eclipse of an obscuring derangement? The cooler side of Doyle's mind rallied in protest. How then to explain the figure in black he'd encountered twice now, the man Jack had identified as his brother? There were the gray hoods, and the seance, the destruction of his flat, and the madness of Topping, all consistent with Sparks' story.
Anything in Blavatsky about the Seven or a Black Lord? Asked Sparks.
What's that? Said a startled Doyle.
I'm not as conversant as you are with her work.
Doyle rummaged through his scattered recollections of Blavatsky.
I recall something about an entity, the Dweller on the Threshold. At the end of each term of physical life, it has had more than a few, apparently, Blavatsky claims this being retires to a limbo at the door between worlds, collecting around it the lost, corrupted souls of persons who fell to its influence while alive and followed it blindly to their deaths.
Are they the Seven?
I don't recall a specific number, but they were spoken of collectively.
Now what do you suppose this dweller would be on about once it got its feet back on terra firma?
Well, nothing too out of the ordinary, I imagine, said Doyle, refusing to commit himself emotionally to the answer he knew was correct.
World dominion, total enslavement of the human race. With a good deal more sophisticated weaponry available to the bugger this time around, our capacity for mass butchery has increased 100-fold.
I would have to agree with you, said Doyle, recalling the presence on the list of Drummond and his burgeoning munitions empire.
Larry led the carriage off the road onto a cart path leading through a dense copse of woods. Emerging into the clearing on the far side, they were greeted by the heartwarming sight of the Stirling 422 they'd left in Battersea, waiting on north-running tracks. Behind it trailed a full coal hopper, and even more encouragingly, a passenger car. Emerging from the cab was none other than Brother Barry, late of Pentonville Prison. Sparks and Doyle boarded the passenger car, and the brothers took to the engine. The sun slid low on the horizon. They would make most of their northern run at night. After an hour had passed, Barry joined them and laid out a peasant's supper of bread, apples, cheese, salted cabbage, and red wine. Sparks ate alone at the table, making notations and working with his maps. Doyle sat with Barry in the galley.
"How did you get out?" asked Doyle.
"Coppers let me go. Hoped I'd lead them straight to you."
"And you eluded them?"
"Only in a trice."
Doyle nodded and took a bite of apple, trying not to appear over-anxious.
"Barry, have you ever seen Alexander Sparks?"
Barry cocked an eyebrow.
"Odd question."
"Why is it odd?"
"That's the maestro's middle name, innit?"
said Barry, nodding towards Sparks.
"You mean to say," said Doyle, "that you've never heard Jack mention a brother by the name of Alexander?"
"Don't mean much if he hadn't. Doesn't gab about hisself."
Barry tipped his cap, wrapped the remainders of the meal, and went back to the engine. The next morning, when Doyle woke, he could smell shag tobacco and strong brewing black tea, but it took the unexpected sound of laughter to rouse him from his bunk to the front of the car.
"Jen," he heard Larry say.
He and Sparks were playing cards at the table.
"Ah, Doyle," said Sparks cheerfully. "Care for a cup of souchong?"
"Please," said Doyle, helping himself immediately to the offered plate of biscuits and hard-boiled eggs.
"Where are we?" asked Doyle.
"An hour from York, 3 hours to Whitby, if the weather holds."
Whitby began as a 6th-century fishing village, grown over the years to a minor port, a seaside resort in the short summer of Northumbria, but in the depths of winter, a forbidding destination. The crumbling Celtic Abbey of St. Hilda dominated the high headlands south of the village proper. The ruins of the ancient abbey cast a long shadow over its less austere successor, Goresthorpe Abbey. Its spire was the first landmark Doyle noticed as the train pulled into the station. The town seemed mired in a gray and fog-bound hibernation. Barry saw to the disposition of the train while Larry took charge of their bags, settling them at a nearby inn. Sparks immediately recruited Doyle for a visit to Bishop Pilfrock's abbey. Bent against the wind, they ascended the steep and winding stairway up the hill. The doors to both church and rectory were secured tight.
"There's no one here,"
said a deep and resonant voice behind them. A giant of a man stood there, 6.5 feet tall if he was an inch. A leonine shock of red hair crowned his massive head, and his face was framed by a thick red beard encrusted with icicles.
"We're looking for the Bishop Pilfrock," said Sparks. "You won't find him here, friends."
The musical lilt of Erin danced in his voice. His face was broad and welcoming.
"I must say you look familiar to me, sir,"
said Sparks.
"Are you gentlemen up from London?"
"We are."
"Abraham Stoker, manager to Henry Irving and his theatrical production company. Bram to me, friends."
Henry Irving. My God, thought Doyle. How many times had he stood for hours to watch the legendary Irving on the stage? Lear, Othello, Benedict to Ellen Terry's Beatrice, the greatest actor of his generation, and perhaps the age. At the Rose and Thistle, a post-and-beam establishment in the center of town, hot mugs of coffee laced with Irish warmed their hands. Stoker, unsolicited, began his tale.
"The world of the theater is a terrifically small community. A stone doesn't enter that pond without the far end receiving immediate word of the ripples. Word came down to me that a certain high-placed gentleman, he was not mentioned by name, had retained certain members of a provincial theater company to enact a newly scripted performance in a private London house. One time only, never to be repeated. Performed for an audience of one. During the performance, new and unanticipated characters made an impromptu entrance, carrying these players far beyond the scope of what they had so carefully rehearsed."
Stoker leaned in closer to them.
"Actual blood was shed. The players scattered. One of their number had fallen at the scene, presumed dead. Needless to say, the survivors feared for their lives and sought protection in the shelter of their original company."
"The Manchester Players," said Sparks.
"Yes. I made some inquiries and learned their itinerary, but the rest of this travelling company had gone missing. Vanished."
"Excuse me, Mr. Stoker," said Doyle urgently. Is there a stage effect, a way of realistically simulating the cutting of someone's throat with a knife or razor?
The blade would have to have a hollow edge, an interior cavity filled with fluid, triggered by a button which the holder would push as he drew it across the skin.
The fluid would be
stage blood, a mix of dye and glycerin, sometimes animal's blood.
Pig's blood on the floorboards of 13 Cheshire Street. She's alive. I know it, thought Doyle.
Thus confronted with the most confounding mystery, continued Stoker, and in light of the profound disinterest of the police, I undertook to pursue what I could learn of their fate myself.
Sparks stood bolt upright. Doyle turned to see what could have wrought such an effect in him. She was standing in the doorway. The impact of seeing and a moment later recognizing Doyle appeared to weaken her. Splotches of color rushed to her cheeks, and she put out a hand to the wall for support. Doyle immediately rose to his feet and moved to her, but he had no sense or later memory of movement. There was only her face, the pale, delicate oval that had so haunted his thoughts and dreams, the soft black curls that framed her forehead before cascading gently to her shoulders, the elegant swan-like gracefulness of her white neck, unmarked, unscarred.
"We must remove ourselves from common view," Sparks' voice intruded sharply. "Will you use Stoker's room? This way, please, madam."
No one spoke until all had entered Stoker's slanted, low-ceilinged room on the second floor and the door secured behind them.
"Please be seated, madam,"
said Sparks, grabbing the back of a chair and slamming it down unceremoniously in the center of the room.
"Here, now, Jack, must you take that tone?" started Doyle. "Be quiet," commanded Sparks. "Or need I remind you, Doyle, that this woman, while in the employ of our enemies, made one of the principal contributions to your entrapment, betrayal, and near murder?"
Doyle found it difficult to move, shamed both by his friend's explosive outburst and the nettle of unattractive truth that he knew nested in his harsh judgment.
"What is your name, madam?" asked Sparks less aggressively.
"Eileen Temple."
"Were you approached by someone in your company regarding the appearance you were eventually to make at 13 Cheshire Street?"
"Sammy Fulgrave. He and his wife Emma were understudies. She was with child. They were in fairly desperate need of money."
"So they introduced you to the man who had offered them this situation, a small, swarthy man with a foreign accent, whereupon he extended the same offer to you?"
"The dark man at the seance," thought Doyle. "The one he'd shot in the leg."
"That he did," said Eileen. "His accent was Austrian, by the way." "He then recruited the fourth and last actor with your assistance?"
"Dennis Cullen was to play my brother."
"What did this man require of you?"
"A private performance for a wealthy friend of his who was interested in spiritualism. It was a sort of a joke on him. His friend was a resolute disbeliever in the spirit world. He planned to invite the man to a seance and then give him a proper fright, using all manner of elaborate stage effects. He said he would be playing a part as well. Actually, the man himself was quite pale."
"Our friend Professor Vamberg, Doyle," said Sparks, in an aside.
"Dennis and I were picked up by carriage and delivered to the house by another man who played the part of Tim, our driver."
"What was his name?"
"I overheard the professor call him Alexander." "Good Lord, that was him," thought Doyle. A shiver ratcheted through him.
"Miss Temple, you should tell them what happened here the night before I found you."
I was awakened in the middle of the night. I wasn't sure, I'm not sure now, if I wasn't dreaming. A shape was standing in the shadows in the corner of my room, a pale face, all in black. His eyes burned. They absorbed light. They never blinked. I was so terrified I couldn't move. I felt as if I were being watched by something less than human. With the first morning light coming in, he was gone. I got up from my bed. The door and windows to my room were locked, as they had been when I went to sleep." Sparks sat down on the bed and looked out the window. His shoulders slumped slightly. Towering over Sparks, Stoker folded his arms and thoughtfully stroked his generous whiskers.
"I spoke with a great many people in Whitby when I first arrived. I met a whaler, a grizzled old dog, 70 if he's a day. He spends many long nights walking by the shore and up the hill towards the abbey where his wife was laid to rest 10 years since. One night, he looked down
and saw a ship had dropped anchor 50 yards offshore. A skiff was coming from it toward the beach. He saw people waiting on shore with lanterns, the bishop among their number. The small boat made land, 2 men on board, 1 all in black. Their cargo was 2 crates, the size and shape of coffins. He saw a large black dog jump off the boat as well. They passed not 10 feet from the old sailor's hiding place. He heard the bishop say something about the arrival of our Lord. And the man in black shouted at him in a harsh voice to be still. The sailor said he watched them carry the crates to the ruins of the ancient abbey up the hill. And he swears he watched that black dog run into the cemetery and disappear into thin air. They found him the next morning in the graveyard. His throat had been ripped apart as if he'd been attacked by an animal.
Armed with lanterns, a shotgun, 1 pistol, and 5 sets of snowshoes procured from the inn, Sparks, Doyle, the brothers, and Eileen, Stoker having elected to exercise the better part of valor, set out in the dark for the ruins of Whitby Abbey. Sparks took the point, consulting a compass to maintain their bearings against the sheer cliffs to their left. Barry and Larry kept a rear guard, while Doyle walked beside Eileen in the middle. She wore pants, boots, and a coat borrowed from Sparks' wardrobe. When they found themselves on a flat plain with the ruins, they saw its impressive scope and its builder's fantastic indulgence of detail. Every ledge, cornice, and lintel were adorned with nightmarish Gothic statuary, ogres, gremlins, and gargoyles, placed here to ward off demons, not to welcome them, remembered Doyle from his history books, or so one hoped. Sparks walked through an open doorway. No one lingered behind. Because of the remaining irregular ribs of roofing, snow had not gathered to the same depths inside. Sparks moved forward toward the altar.
There used to be witches used this place, said Larry. You mean nuns, corrected Barry. Nuns what had lost their way, fella told us in some pub. Whole convent's worth. Devil dodgers one day, consorting with the Prince of Darkness the next. That's why people put the torch to the place. Killed and tortured and otherwise beat the devil right out of them nuns. That's what we heard.
Bring the lanterns, shouted Sparks.
He was standing over a closed and weather-beaten crate lying in the altar area on a loose pile of dirt. Didn't the old man say they brought 2 coffins up here? Said Doyle.
Yes, said Sparks, reaching for the lid.
As his hand made contact with the wood, a chilling howl went up from just outside the building, the cry of a wolf. Another animal answered back, an identical howl from the other side of the abbey. Then a third sounded, at a greater distance. A dizzying welter of blue sparks was spinning in a loose circle around a still point 2 feet above the floor, expanding until it equaled the span of the broken stone pews. A shape defined itself. 5 translucent, cowled figures kneeling in prayer a foot off the floor. The room was suddenly alive with a chorus of soft, whispery voices. Eileen grabbed Larry's lantern, stepped fearlessly off the altar, and started towards the apparitions.
All right, ladies, that'll be quite enough of this prattle. Vespers are done for the evening. Now run along.
Barry immediately jumped down after her. Larry pulled his knives and moved to the right, while Sparks drew a bead with a shotgun.
We run into ghosts in the theater all the time, Eileen said.
Moving as one, the ghostly figures threw back their hoods, revealing hideously deformed and hairless heads. They let loose a shrill, paralyzing shriek and rose up above Eileen to a height of 10 feet or more, preparing to strike. At that moment, 2 huge wolves sprinted into the nave, growling ferociously, making straight for Eileen. Barry dove forward and tackled her to the floor as the wolves leaped to attack. Sparks fired the shotgun, both barrels, knocking the lead animal backwards off its airborne course. In the same instant, Larry let fly his knives. There was a loud yelp as the second animal came down on Barry, handles of the knives protruding from its neck and upper chest. Eileen jumped to her feet, grabbed a lantern, and hurled it at the phantom figures towering above her. The lamp exploded on contact. The images combusted, disintegrating into a shower of silvery sparks and red smoke. Doyle glanced back out the windows. In the distance, to the south, was a line of bright orange lights moving in formation towards their position.
"Torches," said Doyle. "Still a good mile away."
Sparks moved to the crate and dislodged the lid. When Doyle turned back, he saw a sick, stricken expression on Sparks' face and moved to his side to look into the crate.
There was a corpse inside, little more than bones, really, amidst rotting burial clothes and matted clumps of scorched hair and flesh. A photograph in a gilded frame had been positioned between its skeletal hands, a formal posed portrait of a man and woman. "My parents," said Sparks, nodding at the photograph. "And this is my father's body." The outrage that welled inside him rendered Doyle speechless. Any doubts he harbored regarding the monstrousness of Alexander and Sparks' relative innocence were finally irrevocably removed. Moving back to the window, Doyle saw at least six torches and a formidable number of dark shapes. Larry picked up the shotgun and gave a short whistle. Barry jumped to his feet, and the brothers quickly moved out of the cathedral towards the trackers. Steadying his pistol on the window, Doyle took aim on a lead torchbearer. Before he could squeeze off a shot, he heard the rolling crack of the shotgun from off to the left. There were shouts, and two figures in the group went down. Doyle saw Barry wave his lanterns, trying to draw the party away from the abbey. Six attackers ran after Barry. The rest continued towards the ruins. Sparks emptied the oil from his lantern into the crate and set it aflame, intoning something Doyle couldn't hear and committing his father to final rest. Then he turned away from the flames and picked up the lid to the crate by its handles. "This way," he said, heading towards the end of the nave they'd entered. Three gray hoods came in through the front entrance. Sparks whirled, lowered the lid, and drove it into their chests, pushing them back and pinning them against the wall. Doyle stepped forward and methodically fired two shots into each of the hoods as they squirmed behind the wood. Bright light and the rush of many footsteps entered the cathedral. Sparks picked up the lid and ran out the door. Doyle and Eileen scrambled after him. He dropped the lid so it hung over the lip of the hill that sloped steeply away from the ruins. The main band of pursuers burst out of the abbey behind them, a black-cloaked figure in the lead. Doyle jumped aboard as Sparks grabbed Eileen around the waist, pushed her down on the middle of the lid, and followed her onto it, using his weight to tip them over the edge. They slid forward and rapidly accelerated down the incline as the pack reached the lip. The sled gained speed as they plummeted down the embankment in the dark. Every bump and hillock sent them flying into the air, only to be rocked heavily as they hit the snow again. The sheer cliffs falling to the sea somewhere on the right hurtled into Doyle's mind. Just ahead, the white expanse of snowpack ended abruptly in sheer blackness. "The cliffs!" cried Sparks. Doyle threw all his weight to the left. Sparks stuck out his right foot as a runner to push them away from the brink, and moments later that foot was suspended out over thin air. They screamed as the sled rocketed along the edge of the cliff for 20 yards, scraping stone, before Doyle's crude course correction inched them away from the precipice. He could see the shape of the new abbey ahead on their left. "Headstones!" Doyle shouted. There was no way to break, and a massive mausoleum dead ahead suddenly gave no opportunity to maneuver. Doyle yanked on the handles, turning them sideways. They went into a skid, hit a bump, flew skyward, and the coffin lid splintered beneath them. Doyle hit the snow, clutching the broken handles in his hands. Eileen and Sparks landed out of Doyle's sight.
Jack?
Having touched down in a drift without suffering any disabling injury, Doyle's first thought was the sound that came back to him was sobbing. Was it Eileen? He realized Eileen was laughing. She emerged from a nearby snowbank, covered head to toe in white. Then he heard Sparks laughing. The recent terror had been so completely overwhelming that for the moment there seemed no more sensible a response. Doyle felt the giggles come over him as well, and he gave in to them.
"Jonathan Sparks!"
The words rolled down the slopes from the ruins high above. Then a blood-curdling scream twisted and built to a hideous crescendo.
"Oh, God, the brothers!" said Eileen.
"Bastard!" Doyle raged, surging forward. Sparks put a restraining hand on Doyle's shoulder.
"That's what he wants from us."
"You can't leave them," protested Eileen.
"They're soldiers," said Sparks. "They know the risks."
He walked away. "You've got your brother's blood in you, Jack Sparks," said Eileen to Sparks back. Sparks stopped, tensed, but didn't turn, then continued on. A note had been pinned to Stoker's door.
"Stoker's hired a carriage and started back to London," Sparks said. "He has his family to consider."
"Can't blame him for that," said Doyle.
"He's bequeathed us the use of his room."
Sparks pocketed the note and opened the door. Eileen entered. Sparks detained Doyle in the hallway.
"Stay with her. If I'm not back by dawn, try and make your way to London."
"Jack, what are you going to do?"
Sparks gave a wave without looking back as he moved quickly down the stairs. Doyle was about to close the door.
"Don't go," Eileen said. "You should rest."
"Stop being a doctor, for heaven's sake. I don't particularly wish to spend my last night on Earth alone, do you?" Doyle acquiesced, but remained across the room. She gave him a wry look, sat up on the bed, and caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror on the vanity. Her hair was tangled in disarray. "I suppose a hairbrush is too providential to hope for," she said.
"As a matter of fact, it's one of the few possessions I have remaining to me," said Doyle.
From his bag he produced his brush and comb set. Eileen took off the mannish jacket, unpinned her hair, and let the soft black mass of it cascade down the back of her blouse. She shook it out and ran the brush down its lustrous length in long, sensuous strokes, an effect to Doyle's eyes of breathtaking intimacy, a balm to his battered spirits.
"Did you ever see me on stage, Doctor?" she asked.
"I never had the pleasure," said Doyle. "My name is Arthur." She gave the slightest nod, acknowledging the new increment of familiarity. She looked at him in the mirror, out from under the wave of a curl.
"Didn't your mother ever warn you about actresses, Arthur?"
"Miss Temple, Eileen." They looked at each other without pretense.
"Perhaps you should lock the door, Arthur," she said simply.
He did exactly as she requested. Doyle left the bedroom before first light. Eileen was sleeping restfully. He gently lifted her arm from where it lay lightly across his shoulder and kissed the sweet nape of her neck before rising. After quietly locking the door, he walked downstairs to see if a cup of tea could be found. No one was in the kitchen, and he heard nobody moving below. He stepped into the walled courtyard behind the public room. The cold nipped through his shirt, but it felt clean and bracing. He breathed in the air deeply, greedily, trying to fill his lungs beyond their capacity.
"Fresh air is such a tonic," said a voice behind him.
Alexander Sparks stood wrapped in his black cloak, motionless. His eyes were pale and evenly set under dark slices of brow, with long black lashes of surprising delicacy. Lank brown hair hung straight to his shoulders, swept back off a high, smooth forehead. Only his mouth belied the geometric austerity of the arrangement. The lips were full, rosebud, red and moist. As he spoke, a serpentine tongue flicked out from behind the small, neat lines of his teeth, the only visible concession to insatiable appetites that lit the man's interior. Doyle was reminded how much power was generated by absolute stillness. Doyle lowered his hands and gently touched his pockets.
"I believe you've left your gun in the room with Miss Temple," said Alexander.
"What do you want?" asked Doyle.
"I fear, Doctor, that my young brother John may have imparted to you some severe and perfidious misperceptions regarding myself."
Doyle paused. "I should like to get my coat. I'm very cold."
"Of course."
Doyle edged back into the building. How supremely confident or heedlessly arrogant the man was, thought Doyle, allowing me to walk away when I'm dead bang within striking distance. At the room, Doyle slid in the key and opened the door. Eileen was gone. So that was it then. He kept me there long enough for them to take her. Doyle went for his coat. The pistol was gone. He opened his bag, rifling through the medical supplies for a handful of vials and two syringes. Wary he had aroused suspicion by taking too long, Doyle hurried down the stairs. Alexander waited near the open front door.
"Where is she?" asked Doyle. Alexander nodded to the large black coach in the drive. Doyle walked to the carriage and stepped in. Eileen lay on the seat, unconscious. He detected the scent of a disabling chemical around her mouth and nose. Ether, perhaps. The coach door closed and the carriage lurched forward. Doyle turned to find Alexander sitting across from them, displaying that raw bone of a smile.
"There's something you must know about my brother, Doctor. Our parents perished tragically in a fire when Jonathan was little more than a boy, which has led to episodes of acute dementia that have required his being confined to hospitals for the mentally disturbed."
"Why was your brother confined to Bedlam?" asked Doyle, neutrally.
"He was attempting a forced entry to Buckingham Palace, one of John's more persistent delusions. He claims to be working under the direct and secret orders of Her Majesty, investigating an assortment of conspiracies involving threats to the continuity of ascension to the throne, most of which he is convinced I am responsible for. Consequently, he follows after me wherever I go, trying to interfere with my day-to-day affairs. This has been going on for years. Why would he do these things? Doyle asked. As you know, with any mental aberration, it is difficult to say with any certainty. What has he said to you about this matter, Doctor? Alexander asked blandly. He wants to know what I know, realized Doyle. That's what this charade is about. Perhaps he was jealous of your relationship with your mother.
Perhaps so.
And perhaps he was jealous of your father's relations with her as well.
Of course he was.
So much so that he felt compelled to eliminate all his rivals.
That's right.
That's why you set the fire.
Yes.
Doyle stopped. Alexander caught himself. A reptilian coldness instantly sculpted his face into a mask of brutal contempt.
So you do believe that Jonathan killed your parents, said Doyle, boldly attempting to maintain the guilelessness of his inquisition.
Yes.
He appeared bestial. This is what he looks like, thought Doyle. This is his real face. The fact remained that Alexander had, for the moment, been outwitted. Eileen moved. Her respiration deepened. The drug was wearing off. Doyle heard the gates shut behind them as the carriage came to a stop. At the sound of the door, Doyle looked up and saw that Alexander Sparks was gone. A broad, ruddy, smiling face appeared, adorned with two conical tufts of fleecy white hair.
A pleasure it is to welcome you to us.
Bishop Pilfrock, surmised Doyle, spying the man's collar and frock. He helped Eileen from the carriage. Two rows of formally attired servants formed a gauntlet to the entrance of the house, more properly a medieval fortress, wings, flying buttresses, massive round towers topped with banners. The bishop led them to an epic stone staircase. A brawny servant standing outside a door in the hall opened it as they approached, and the bishop extravagantly waved them inside.
Please don't hesitate to rest and refresh yourselves before joining us.
The door closed solidly. Doyle tried the handle. Locked. He moved to the window. Traffic in and out of the heavy gates ran regular and heavy, covered wagons primarily, but a fair number of men on foot, patrols armed with rifles. He looked farther left to the North York moors. Somewhere therein sat the property General Drummond extorted from Lord Nicholson. As the mist lifted in the distance, he could dimly make out low, man-made structures, perhaps storage sheds. Eileen peeled off shirt and trousers as she hobbled to the bath. Resuming his survey, Doyle saw a high, rambling structure serviced by a rail spur running to the west. Beneath the chimneys, an ornate and sentimentally rendered scene of a mother standing in a kitchen, handing a biscuit to a little boy, covered a large expanse of wall, lettering above it inscribed, Mother's Own. Doyle removed his coat, took the vials of medicine concealed in the lining and the syringes from his boots and stuffed them beneath the cushions of a davenport. Then he moved to the bath. Eileen lay back against the angled wall of the tub. Familiarity breeds a few feelings other than contempt, thought Doyle as he lay on the enveloping feather bed. Passion, for one, whether as a result of the drug in her system or need inspired by the precariousness of their position. The urgency and abandon with which Eileen had submitted herself to him fell significantly farther outside his limited experience than their lovemaking of the night before. As he fell asleep, he remembered thinking he was grateful to his mother for her failure to warn him against actresses. Doyle woke with a start. Someone's been in here while we slept, his instincts informed him. His clothes were gone from the floor where he had hastily discarded them. Laid out on the opposite bed were a set of gentleman's evening wear and a woman's black velvet dress. Eileen lay asleep beside him. Doyle found his watch and snapped it open. 4 o'clock. He pulled on the trousers and padded to the window. Armed patrols on the walls still in force. Work had ceased at the adjacent factory,
but a thin line of smoke issued from one of the smaller buildings farther out on the moor. Doyle knotted the bow tie, checked it in the mirror, plumped the handkerchief in his breast pocket, and moved to the door. He found it unlocked. Two men rose from chairs in the hallway as Doyle exited the bedroom. Both appeared in their early 50s and were similarly attired in evening wear. The shorter of the two, a dapper, fastidious man with a trim black beard, smoked a blunt cigar. The taller one bore the broad shoulders and upright carriage of a military man, his white hair trimmed to a rough bristle. With the baleful shadow of General Drummond trailing them, Chandros took Doyle's arm and directed him down the corridor and through a door onto a high balcony. "How do you change man from a dim-witted, randy farm animal to a domesticated, productive tool, ready to roll up his sleeves and pitch in for the greater good? There's the puzzle anybody that aspires to rule has to crack, be it religion, government, business, what have you. Look down there, Doctor. What do you see?" A number of men in identical gray-striped pants and jackets were filing into the compound. "Workers? Factory workers?" said Doyle. Chandros shook his head. "The men you are looking at were until recently the lowest, most degraded form of human filth imaginable. Convicts, mean, vicious, block-headed incorrigibles, brought here, and believe me, the prisons are only too glad to be rid of them, to take part in a program that will prove to be our deliverance from blind enslavement to man's essential nature." The group's movements in the yard were well-drilled, disciplined, but unenthusiastic if not sluggish. "Here and now, for the first time, they are completely rehabilitated, well provided for, and willing to give an honest day's work." "How?" asked Doyle. How is it done?" "The brain is a physical organ, like the lungs or the liver, and it can be refashioned in ways we are only beginning to understand."
Surgically?" asked Doyle.
"I'm interested in results, Doctor. You see before you the more than encouraging results we have begun to realize with this program, and not just with those factory workers. Well, the entire household staff is comprised of our successful efforts." Doyle felt his head spinning. Automatons deprived of a will of their own. He tried not to betray his profound revulsion. That's what they wanted the land for, Doyle realized. Isolation to do this ungodly work. Doyle looked down at the central courtyard, his eye caught by a single wagon pulling into what looked like a service entrance. As the driver dismounted, a body clinging to the undercarriage rolled out from beneath the wagon and slipped into the shadows. Jack! A deep bell rang somewhere inside the house.
"Ah, dinner will be served shortly," said Chandros. "Why don't you see if that charming companion of yours is ready to join us, Doctor?"
Doyle stepped quickly to his room, where the formidable servant was once again stationed at the door. Doyle caught the blank, reflectionless plane of the man's eyes. Seated before a vanity, Eileen used the mirror to apply the slightest blush to her lips. A choker studded with what appeared to be diamonds encircled her neck. The form hugging off the shoulder black velvet dress elevated her innate glamour to a classical level. "They left makeup and jewelry as well," she said. "What on earth are they up to?" "Why don't we go find out?" said Doyle, moving to the davenport and retrieving the syringes. He slipped them into his breast pocket, making certain they didn't create a giveaway bulge in the line. "Jack's somewhere inside," said Doyle. "Good. We won't give up without a fight. The bastards killed my fiancée. He was sitting beside me at the séance that night, playing my brother." Doyle collected himself. "Dennis?" "Yes, Dennis." "I had no idea. I'm so terribly sorry." Eileen nodded and turned away. "I've a 4-inch hatpin in my clutch," she whispered. "Tell me when, and I won't hesitate to use it." As they exited the hall, music from below was accompanied by the buzz of conversation. Eileen wrapped her arm securely around Doyle's, and they started down the grand staircase. The sight below was rare and sumptuous, lit by enormous candelabras. The table was set with fine silver and crystal. A string quartet played in the corner. 8 chairs were occupied by guests, dressed as if for a royal occasion. Sir John Chandros sat at the head of the table. As he spied Doyle and Eileen descending, conversation died and attention shifted towards the stairs. At the prompting of the silver-haired gent to his right, a man in his early 20s rose to greet them, portly and pale, bedecked with ribbons, medals, and a sash,
A constellation of new stains blotted his immaculately starched white dicky. Bishop Pilfrock steered them straight towards the young man, who waited as patiently as a well-trained ape.
"May I present His Royal Highness Prince Albert Victor Edward, the Duke of Clarence?" said the bishop with extreme unction. "Dr. Arthur Conan Doyle."
"How do you do?"
said the Duke blankly, nothing registering in his eyes. "Your Highness," said Doyle.
"Miss Eileen Temple,"
said the bishop. "Your Highness," said Eileen.
"The weather today has been unseasonably mild," said the Duke, with the spontaneous animation of a wind-up toy.
Doyle was inundated by the sour wine saturating the prince's breath. The silver-haired man to the prince's right asserted himself, taking the prince by the arm. The bishop held out a chair as Eileen sat to the right of Chandros, directly across from Alexander Sparks. The upright hulk of General Drummond stood on Sparks' left. Doyle took his seat directly across from the only other female at the table, a darkly handsome woman whom he recognized as Lady Caroline Nicholson. Black hair bonneted a strong face, her features hawkish and unforgiving, more sensual than the photo had been able to convey. Her black eyes glittered with predatory heat. She smiled cryptically. The man to Doyle's immediate right had difficulty retaking his seat. His right leg extended out, the bulge of a poultice ballooning the pant leg around his knee. Even with the spectacles he wore and the absence of makeup, Doyle recognized him as the dark man from the seance, the man he had shot in the leg, Professor Arminius Vamberg. So they were all accounted for, all seven, and the grandson of Queen Victoria in the bargain.
"I made the discovery during my years in the Caribbean," offered Professor Vamberg, unsolicited.
What's that?" asked Doyle. The professor smiled politely.
"Less developed societies maintain a direct relationship to the natural world. As a consequence, they enjoy a more straightforward experience of that part of nature which remains unseen to us, the spirit world, specifically the world of the devas, or elementals, who inform and inhabit the physical world, which we presumptively assume to be the limit of existence. They are known by different names in different cultures. In Ireland, you know them as leprechauns. Here in Britain, they are called brownies or elves. The Germans, of course, know them as kobolds or goblins."
"I'm familiar with mythology," said Doyle.
"It is a great deal more than mere mythology, Doctor."
"Roast partridge or a bed of cabbage,"
announced the bishop. There must be some mistake, thought Doyle. This was a single wing, and it was easily the size of a turkey's, and that cabbage leaf covered the entire plate. Where did one find produce like this in the depths of winter? The meat was succulent and as tender and flavorful as anything he'd ever eaten.
"These figures of legend are in actuality the unseen architects and builders of the natural world," continued Vamberg. "They are real, shy creatures, extremely reticent, but once contact is made, and I was able to do so initially with the help of Caribbean tribal priests, one quickly learns how extremely eager they are to cooperate with us."
"Cooperate? How?"
"By in doing what they do best," said Vamberg. "Growing things."
He picked up a cabbage leaf off his plate.
"What if I were to tell you that the cabbage seed that produced this leaf was planted in dry sand 3 weeks ago, deprived of all water or nutrients? And when it was freshly dressed this afternoon, this bird was only 2 weeks old."
Glancing around the table, Doyle noticed Alexander Sparks refrained from eating.
"Another benefit came from that encounter," said Vamberg. "On the island of Haiti, the priests introduced me to an elixir of various herbs, roots, and organic extracts they said the elementals had revealed to them. When administered in the right amount, in conjunction with certain medical practices, this compound virtually strips a man or woman of their conscious will."
"That's how Haiti solved the servant problem,"
chimed in the bishop with a broad wink.
"It was years later, during my travels in the high country of Tibet, that I first met a man with the vision to see how this compound might one day be utilized in a broader, more socially useful fashion."
Vamberg gave a nod to Alexander Sparks. A crash of crockery startled Doyle. A servant on the far side of the table had dropped a plate. The man bent down, his movements addled and sluggish, and attempted to scrape up the fragments of china and the scattered food around it with his hands. The back of the man's neck had been recently and roughly shaved, and a vivid, suppurating triangular scar ran across its length. Crude blue threads stitched the flaps of the wound loosely together. Doyle's heart sank. It was Barry. His eyes were dead, light and life entirely gone from them. Doyle looked to his left. Eileen was pale, fighting her emotions. He gestured to her, "Show them nothing." Two servants lifted Barry and guided him out of the room. "They put him here so we'd see how they've decimated his mind and robbed him of his soul," thought Doyle furiously. He wanted to kill them for it. Alexander grinned viciously, looking slowly back and forth at Doyle and Eileen, showing his teeth. "He likes to see fear," realized Doyle. "He feeds off it."
"You were saying, Professor?" said Alexander.
"We pursued the acquaintance of elemental forces in other countries, other continents. They were more than willing to disclose their secrets to us, and among them Doctor are wonders to behold, life itself, in trade for a service which only we, in turn, could provide for them. These elementals of the earth had once been united under the governance of a unifying spirit, a being tragically, savagely misunderstood by our religiously intolerant Western forebears."
"The devil?" said Doyle.
"The Christian conception of him, yes. The elementals asked for our cooperation in returning this great spirit into the world, there to assume its rightful seat among them. It seems only humans could provide such a service."
Reaching in to grab the decanter of wine, Prince Eddie succeeded in knocking it over. A dark look passed between Alexander and Dr. Gull.
"His Highness extends his regrets," said Gull. "But it has been a most exhausting day. He will take the remainder of his meal in chambers before retiring."
He took the Duke firmly by the arm and led him towards the stairs. As Doyle watched him go, something heavy dropped onto the table in front of him. His manuscript.
"How did you come to know of our work?" asked Lady Nicholson.
"I may as well confess," said Doyle, casually praying his powers of invention would not pick this moment to fail him. "The plain truth is, I've made a study of you. I hold no place in the world to compare remotely with anyone's at this table. What I do share with you is a passionate sympathy for your objectives, and I have nurtured a perhaps reckless aspiration that by creating an opportunity to meet you face to face, I could persuade you to allow me to play some part in the fulfillment of your plans." Doyle could see significant doubts persisting.
"What about my brother?" asked Alexander.
He abducted me against my will, twice, and came close to killing me more times than that. It has come to my understanding he has escaped from Bedlam. I'm just grateful to be rid of him."
"What do you know of our plan?" asked Lady Nicholson.
"You are attempting to return this dweller on the threshold to the physical plane. Your first effort, involving the birth of your son, Lady Nicholson, the blonde child whom I saw depicted at the séance, has sadly and tragically failed."
That sent a bolt rocketing through the woman and on through the rest in a tumbling ricochet. Doyle had gambled and come up aces.
"The physical vehicle was not strong enough," said the woman, without a trace of grief. "The boy was unable to bear the weight."
"We impute the father," added Bishop Pilfrock piously. "A most weak and unserviceable man."
"One can only trust that your next standard-bearer, Prince Edward, proves to be as physically advantageous as his position in the world," said Doyle, taking another stab in the dark. Another nerve struck.
"Given the risk involved," said Lady Nicholson, "it is altogether fitting and proper that we look for proof of your suitability."
Doyle saw a straight razor land on the table in front of him.
"We would like you to kill Miss Temple," said Sparks.
Time stopped inside Doyle's mind.
"Yes, all right," Doyle said calmly.
He picked up the razor, took a step towards Eileen,
then pivoted and used the momentum of his turn to slash the razor down at Vamberg, slicing through his jacket and across his arm and hand. Reaching into his pocket with one motion, Doyle pulled out the syringes. Eileen slipped the bishop's grasp and drove her right fist directly into the face of Chandros. The man screamed violently. Eileen had wedged a 4-inch hatpin deeply into the man's eye socket. Blood streamed out between Chandros's spasming fingers. Doyle thrust the first syringe into Pilfrock's fleshy throat, emptying the drug into the man's carotid artery. The bishop screamed. Halfway out his mouth, the sound cut off, strangulated by paralysis. A massive dose of digitalis raced into his bloodstream, where it would within seconds stop his heart. "Run!" shouted Doyle. Stunned by the suddenness of the attack, servants only now moved towards them from both sides of the table. Drummond rose to his feet. Lady Nicholson pushed her chair back from the table. Alexander Sparks was no longer beside her. Doyle had lost sight of him. Eileen ran towards the stairs. Vamberg clawed at Doyle with his wounded arm, nails raking Doyle's skin, drawing blood. Doyle fumbled the second syringe into position, jammed it hard into Vamberg's upper left thigh, and hit the plunger. Half the hypodermic's contents emptied into the femoral artery before the man jerked violently away and the needle broke off in his leg. Now the needle's function reversed. Voluminous arcs of blood pumped out in the opposite direction. Doyle pushed off for the stairs. He saw Drummond advance, leading a charge of servants, revolver in hand. Doyle heard a sharp whistle, and a silver star embedded itself in the man's forehead. A dark shape flew over the balustrade and sailed onto the servants. The attackers tumbled around Eileen as Doyle reached her on the landing. Dressed in servant garb, the figure who'd ridden them down jumped to his feet and began hurling assailants who hadn't been knocked senseless off the staircase. "Go on," said Jack Sparks. Doyle and Eileen rushed down a bare, narrow servant's passage. Sparks threw a vial onto the landing that produced a thick, noxious plume of smoke and followed them. The passage walls grew rougher as they moved down, woodwork giving way to masonry and masonry to raw rock. Sounds of pursuit behind them grew encouragingly remote. Around another corner, a heavy oaken door blocked the passageway. Sparks listened carefully, then lifted the latch. "Where did you go last night, Jack?" asked Doyle. "For help. A company of Royal Marines and 2 squadron of cavalry are on their way from Middleborough. They'll arrive here before dawn." Never had Doyle been more willing to take him at his word. They found themselves outside, barrels stacked around them. Horses' hooves, carriages, and angry voices could be heard nearby. "Wait here," Sparks said. He returned minutes later with 2 servants' outfits. They changed behind the barrels as Sparks kept vigil. Eileen stuffed her hair under a mob cap. Through a gap in the barrels, they looked out at the courtyard. Servants and convicts ran in every direction. Sparks stood and headed out from behind the barrels. Doyle and Eileen followed, heads down, blending into the milling mix of the courtyard. No one stopped or questioned them. It wasn't long before they cleared the open gates. The path led directly to the biscuit factory. Inside the doors, the air was sulphurous, choked with smoke, coal dust, floating cinders. Conveyors carried rough ore to crucibles suspended over howling, incendiary blast furnaces. Massive lipped cauldrons poised over iron molds the size of houses. The army of shirtless workers moving about, blackened by the foul atmosphere, dwarfed by the monolithic machineries, seemed entirely superfluous. Hulking shapes on trolleys leading to the tracks outside suggested cannon, but of a size far greater than they had ever seen. Engines of war of some kind, of a war not yet glimpsed or even guessed at. They stepped away from the doors. They saw a bright glow issuing from a shadowy structure a half mile south of the tracks. They heard what sounded like gunfire inside. Keeping as low as the limited cover of the ground would allow, they crept up the hill and skirted the edge of the compound. 2 structures set on a level patch of land. 6 stunted chimneys rose from the second building. Smoke and red heat chugged steadily from them. A fetid, malodorous stench swept over them, the overwhelming force of it driving them to their knees. Sparks gestured for Eileen to hold her position, and the 2 men inched up the hillock. Doyle pointed to a figure he recognized in a row of men who stood idly outside the first building. Armed guards flanked the doorway. Rifle fire rang out from inside. The steel door to the building opened from inside, and the first group of men prodded inside. A row of riflemen lined an interior wall, reloading their weapons. Beyond them, carts laden with sprawling corpses were wheeled by men in gray down the passage to the second building, to the ovens. There was no stealth, no subterfuge. Sparks strode up to the guards at the door and cut them down before either man could lift his rifle. Doyle retrieved the keys and removed the irons from the hands and feet of the second column of men. None moved. All bore the traumatic stamp of Vamberg's vile alteration. These were his failures. This was where they disposed of their waste. Doyle took Barry by the hand and led him away. He offered no resistance or recognition. Sparks remained behind. Doyle heard a volley of shots and screams from within. Eileen moved up the path to join him. The shots ceased. The sudden silence of the moors seemed as vast as the span of stars above. Sparks appeared over the rise. He discarded the rifle as he drew near. His face and clothes were awash with blood, which looked black in the moonlight. Behind him, a column of flame shot up into the sky. He had set fire to the buildings. Sparks gathered Barry tenderly in his arms and carried him towards the railroad tracks. A curious sight appeared, an engine and two cars backing towards them down the tracks from the west. "It's our train," said Doyle. Larry leaped from the cab and met Sparks as he gently laid his burden down. The single, simple cry Larry gave out when he saw his fallen brother rent the still surface of the night like a spear. Barry moved his lips.
"Finish,"
Barry had said. Tears streaming from his eyes, Larry looked up at Jack, who gestured to himself. Larry slowly shook his head. Sparks gave a look to Doyle and moved away. Doyle guided Eileen further down the tracks, then looked back over his shoulder. Larry bent down to kiss Barry's cheek, then slid his soft hands around his brother's neck. Doyle turned aside. Eileen trembled violently in his arms. On board the train, Eileen moved somnolently to the berth in the rear. Sparks sat at a table, the decanter of brandy open, two glasses out. The warmth of the liquor spread through Doyle's belly, allotting some small distance from the horrors.
"The story the old fisherman told Stoker when he saw them come ashore from the schooner," said Sparks. "He said they brought two coffins. What was in the second?"
"We never found it."
"If this being they spoke of had in fact lived previously, presume for the moment they had some means of discovering the person it had been. Is it inconceivable Alexander and the Seven believed they required those remains in order to return it to life?"
"I suppose not."
"Then that second coffin becomes the key to their entire enterprise. I imagine that wherever he might be, Alexander even now has it in his possession."
"Why would they do it, Jack?"
"A king can wage war. They're in the business of building weapons."
Doyle nodded.
"And the convicts?
Vamberg's drug."
Sparks paused. "Building a private militia."
Doyle finished the brandy. He paused, treading lightly now.
"The police told me you'd escaped from Bedlam." "You gave them my name."
Sparks poured himself another brandy.
"I was confined to Bedlam for a period of weeks 6 months ago. So ordered by a man I was investigating, Dr. William Gull. I was kept alone in a cell in pitch darkness, the straitjacket never removed. I frequently felt someone observing me. I realized then that Alexander was the man I had been hunting all along."
The muscles in Sparks' jaw clenched tight. His eyes went hard, his voice hoarse with emotion, withdrawn. Doyle staggered to the rear of the car and looked in through the drawn curtains at Eileen in the lower berth. Holding at bay a befogged awareness that this decision carried more import than could possibly seem apparent, Doyle climbed to the upper berth. Sleep, a sonorous, black, unconscious sleep, came and took him quickly. Doyle opened his eyes. The train was not moving. Daylight filtered in. He looked at his watch. 2:15 in the afternoon, and parted the curtains. A train yard, the one they had used before in Battersea. He climbed down. The lower berth was empty, as was the rest of the car. Doyle searched, but there was no sign of the engine anywhere in the yard. In his pocket was a thick roll of 10-pound notes, well over a year's salary. It was the most money he'd ever seen at once in his life. Crossing the Lambeth Bridge, he looked down at the churning, impersonal grey water of the Thames and tried to decide where he should go. He turned away from the river and made for the Strand. He bought a leather satchel, a pair of sturdy shoes, socks, shirts, suspenders, a pair of trousers, articles of underwear, and an expensive suit from one of the first men's outfitters he encountered. He packed the clothes in the satchel and hired a room at the Hotel Melwyn. He then bathed, shaved, and returned to his room. No sooner had he finished changing when a knock came at the door. A hall boy conveyed a message. A carriage waited for the gentleman downstairs. Waiting inside the hansom was Inspector Claude Lebeau. Doyle took a seat across from him, and they drove away. The ride took 20 minutes, during which Lebeau twice consulted his watch. Doyle heard gates open outside as they slowed. The carriage stopped, and Lebeau preceded Doyle out of the cab. They were greeted by a solid, dignified man, walked through a dimly lit corridor, and into a comfortable sitting room. The door opened. There was a shock at seeing her in the flesh at such a close distance. The familiar face, plain, doughty, as familiar to any English boy as that of his own mother's. She smiled at sight of him, an animation never hinted at in pictures, and her smile was dazzling, a diamond in a field of posies.
"Dr. Doyle, I hope this has not proved an inconvenience," said Queen Victoria.
No, Your Majesty." He bowed, hoping to offer some semblance of the proper protocol.
"It seems you and I have a very good friend in common," said the Queen.
She's speaking of Jack, he realized.
"We had a visit from our friend recently. He has told me how you proved such a very great help to him in a matter of no small importance to myself and to my family. And I understand that as a result of your generous assistance, you have experienced some difficulty with the police. You may consider this a cause for no further concern."
"I am most deeply appreciative," he said.
"Now, we will demand of you, Doctor, your oath never to speak on any of what you have heard or witnessed to any living soul as long as you may live."
"Yes, upon my life." Queen Victoria smiled once more, the unexpected radiance dazzling again, and turned to go. Back at the waiting carriage, the secretary opened the door for Doyle and handed him a small rectangular package.
"Her Majesty's compliments."
Doyle waited to open the package until he was again inside his room. It was a fountain pen, a sleek black fountain pen. It lay as delicately balanced in his hand as a feather. He found a letter waiting for him at the desk. "Dearest Arthur, by the time you receive this, I will have left England. My heart had been so broken when we met, and the circumstances were thereafter so extreme, a moment never came that provided me with either the time or luxury to grieve. Your kindness, your decency, your tenderness to me, and your courage are a beacon that will guide me through whatever remains of this dark passage. Be strong, my darling Arthur. I know in my heart that the light you possess will burn to the great benefit of this world long after our footprints have been washed from the sand. I love you. Your Eileen." Late one night, some weeks later, there came a knock at Doyle's door. Larry stood outside. He removed his coat and took a seat by the fire, accepting Doyle's offer of a brandy. He seemed smaller than Doyle remembered, his face harder and more careworn.
"We left you at the station like that. Didn't like it. Governor said you'd had enough. No reason to trouble you any more. First thing was, we had to give me brother a proper burial. Took him home. Put him in the ground beside our mum. Then Mr. Sparks, he has some business in London. I goes down to Brighton. Weeks go by. Then here he comes one night with news. A schooner left port at Whitby in the first week of the new year. Sail for Bremen. That's where we're going now, he tells me. We catch the next pack across the channel. Make our way to the German harbour of Bremen. Inquiries are made. We're looking for a couple what boarded in Whitby. Seems they brung a coffin in the cargo hold. This couple left Bremen by train to the south. Here the trail goes cold, but the governor, he's got one more notion."
"Salzburg," Doyle interjected.
"That's right, sir. Where the brothers went to university, Austria. We goes over that old town with a louse comb. Jitney driver remembers picking up a couple what answers to our description. Took them to a town 2 hours north, called Branau am Inn. Seems this couple took a house there on the spot, paid cash money for it.
Lucky for us, there's a nosy Parker living next door. She seen him arrive, and they did unload a large wooden crate from the wagon. Kept strange hours, this couple. Lights burning all hours of the night. Were they there when you arrived?
Larry shook his head.
Gone a week, she says. We goes into this house ourselves. It was as if somebody dealt a furnace to the place, melted it halfway down, then let it cool. Everything soft. The walls like aspic.
Doyle knew these effects only too well. Blavatsky had described it as something breaking through from the other side.
Did they leave anything behind? That coffin, what was left of it? Scorched, split to toothpicks, empty, sitting on a pile of dirt like what we've seen at Whitby Abbey.
Doyle didn't like the look on Larry's face. Something worse was coming.
We endeavoured to pick up their trail again. Led us southwest to a little town in Switzerland, between Zurich and Basel. A resort area. There's a waterfall folks like to see. Reichenbach Falls. Five cascades. Over 200 feet high. We checked the hotel hard by the falls. Couple in question's been there 2 days now. We looked to their room. No one about. Jack asks me to wait by the door while he goes round to the other side. Little time goes by. I get a bad feeling up the back of me neck, so I runs out of there. There's a path leading up the mountains where one goes to look down at the falls, and there I can see Jack running up that path. I hear pistol shots. Jack's wrestling with a man in black, and I know right off it's Alexander. Not sure who's fired those shots, but neither looks it. I never seen two men go at each other so fierce and bad. Match strength for strength, blow for blow, both battered and bleeding. I'm ashamed to say I was paralyzed by the sight. I couldn't budge from that spot. And as I watched, I saw Jack begin to take a slight advantage. Alexander takes a step back near the rim, and the ground gives out beneath him. And for an eternal moment, he hangs on the edge of that cliff, and then he goes. Just as he's about to disappear into that black gorge, he reaches out and he grabs our Jack by the boot, and Jack staggers, digs in, and holds back, but the sheer weight of the man pulls Jack over the edge with him, and I watches them fall, sir, down, down that long way, down till the mist of the falls swallows them up entire.
Tears were flowing down his face. Doyle couldn't move.
Did they find the bodies? I don't know, sir, because in that next moment, a shot hits the ground at my feet, and I see that hellcat on the path above me.
Lady Nicholson?
Yes, sir, and so I ran, and I don't think I stopped running till I got to the station and boarded the next train. I don't know if they found the bodies, but it was a terrible long fall, sir, and I seen those rocks 200 feet below. And I'm very much afraid that Mr. Jack Sparks has been taken from us long before his time. Long before the good a man such as he could do has been done by half.
In the weeks that passed after hearing of the events at Reichenbach Falls, Doyle began to again crave the numbing comfort of prosaic daily routine. He sought employment and accepted an obscure medical post in the provincial harbor town of South Sea Portsmouth. The striking ordinariness of his patient's complaints proved a tonic for him. He met Louise Hawkins, a soft-spoken, comely woman in her early 20s. Later that summer, Doyle and Louise were married. The following spring, their first child was born, a daughter, Mary Louise. With an unsurpassed sense of contentment and security informing his personal life, Doyle found himself able for the first time to consider with some perspective the time he had spent in Jack's company. He knew that none of the royals or government officers whom Jack had served could ever publicly acknowledge his contributions, but then he had never looked for or expected personal reward. Although he had personally sworn his service and secrecy in this matter to the Queen, and she was to call on him again repeatedly in years to come, Doyle, in the end, devised a way to honor his sworn oath to her while paying tribute to the memory of the late Jonathan Sparks. That night, with his wife and child lying safely in their beds, he reached for the pen that the Queen had given him and sat down to write a story about their mysterious friend. A bright April morning in 1890, publishing success about to transform his life forever, Dr. Doyle, Louise, and 3-year-old daughter Mary Louise are enjoying their first excursion abroad.
There the river goes deep there, at the base of the rocks. Current below is deep, fast. The bodies there are not always found. Doyle stands on the boardwalk at the rim overlooking Reichenbach Falls as his hired Swiss guide, a broad-faced, genial young man, points down at the cataract below. Further down the boardwalk, strolling with her mother, little Mary Louise is captivated by the sight of an infant in its passing perambulator. The parents, an unremarkable lower-middle-class couple, are taking their first vacation since the birth of their son the year before. The father, Alois, is a customs official. The mother, Clara, a simple country girl from Bavaria.
"Look at the eyes, Mummy," says Mary. "Doesn't it have the most beautiful eyes?"
"Wo kommen Sie her aus?" asks Louise of the young parents.
"Wir kommen aus Austria," answers Alois.
"Braunau," adds Clara. "Braunau am Inn."
Clara turns the pram around and reaches down to straighten her son's bedding.
"Komm mit, Adolf,"
she says to her infant son. The family moves off. Mary spies her father and runs to tell him all about the baby with the extraordinary eyes. But by the time she reaches him, the thought has fled from her mind like the mist rising from the falls below.
Copyright Phoenix Books 2010.